Welcome to the Rick Smith Show, sisters and brothers, Central Pennsylvania progressives, believers in the middle class, in revitalizing the American dream, in letting all of the people vote all of the time, in democracy of, by, and for the people. Welcome to the Rick Smith Show, the voice of working Central Pennsylvania. There's a little role reversal going on here. Your co-hosts tonight are me, Stephen Herzenberg, executive director and economist from the Keystone Research Center, and Erwin Aronson. And the role reversal is that usually Erwin gets here at the early hour of 8:57 and is sitting in here when I come in at about 9:01 at the end of the intro. So Erwin's still gathering himself together.
Erwin is very gathered. You just are fooling.
All right.
You think you can get away with this because people can't see what you're doing? I know better.
I have proof. The video camera is rolling. So,
well, this is the great face for radio, Erwin Aronson, counselor to the stars and a member of the law firm of Willig, Williams, and Davidson. That's www.wwdlaw.com.
And some of you who have sharp ears will be able to tell that he is a little bit less voluble than usual because he's actually been sick all day, and you can hear it a little bit in his voice.
Now, but, the drugs are wonderful.
But he dragged himself out for me. No, I don't think it was for me. I'm not sure it was for Brett. Not even for Rick, but I think it's for you out there in the listening audience.
It was for Brett and the listening audience.
The listening audience.
And my opportunity to save America one more time from the otherwise dangerous whim and caprice of Stephen Herzenberg.
On his own? We've only had that pleasure. You've only had that pleasure once. You got to give Erwin credit.
Just
credit or bad checks. Went to the doctor this morning, and the prescription was take 3 hours co-hosting the Rick Smith Show and call me in the morning.
and he didn't give me his number.
I tell you, there's nothing. I've had the week from heck. I'm not quite sure what I'm allowed to say on the radio, so I'll play it safe. I've been
the week from Hades.
I've been running around like a banshee since pretty early Monday, driving to Pittsburgh, an all-day meeting, flying to New Orleans by way of Atlanta for a conference that lasted 2 days, flying back by way of Atlanta, getting home by around midnight Wednesday, getting on a train at 8 in the morning to go to New York yesterday, getting back from that at 11:30, getting up in time to be late for an 8 o'clock meeting this morning. But I still scheduled to do this show because the reality is, Erwin, that this is a tonic. When you do the spade work that you do as a legal counselor and that I do as an economist, a chance to really air honestly the passions you have and how much you care about working people and that they not get a raw deal actually is a tonic.
Well, I agree it's a tonic, but not nearly as much as the tonic of hearing that you actually put in an honest week of work this week.
Not really, yeah. All of that audience.
We still have a day plus left.
was for Erwin, who's my general counsel, and also for my board, if any of my board of directors are out there listening. After all these years, I still have to prove I work hard enough for them.
Some people work hard and some people hardly work. You have to decide what column you fall into.
Yes, indeed. So let me give folks a couple of websites, but first of all, a phone number. If you want to join the conversation and give the audience some relief from me and Erwin, it's 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-RICK. So please do join the conversation. Some websites. The website of the Rick Smith Show is www.ricksmithshow.com. The website of the Keystone Research Center is keystoneresearch.org, where you can find all the latest information on the economy from the perspective of working families and also ideas about how to fix the economy to rebuild the middle class. The website of the Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center, www.pennbpc.org, which is the Tax and Budget Project of the Keystone Research Center, where you can find critical information on, bless you, Brett. I don't know whether people can hear Brett sneezing in the background. My guess is that they can. But anyway.
My guess is that they have now in any event, and yeah. I didn't realize I could pass this thing along so quickly.
Irwin and I are both wiping ourselves off here.
Yeah.
So anyway, www.pennbpc.org is where you find information on the budget, on tax issues, on voter ID, on shale, Marcellus and Utica shale issues. So those are your key resources. And do you want to give your law firm's website, Irwin?
Absolutely. For working men and women in Pennsylvania and around the country who hear us, the website for access to workers' legal rights is www.wwdlaw.com. The law firm of Willig, Williams, and Davidson. And if you click into that website, you get to see a number of things that our firm has been involved with of late, legal issues facing working men and women, unemployment compensation, workers' compensation, privatization issues, education issues, tax and policy issues. And you may even see a wonderful two-paragraph biography of almost everybody in our law firm, including me.
Two paragraphs.
Yeah, two paragraphs.
Someone else must have edited that down.
Well, I did.
See, I've seen Irwin's full-length resume.
I looked at your resume the other day, and I was thunderstruck.
I'm sorry.
I saw this, and I decided. I see Hirschenberg taking credit for this.
This is one of those cases where yours is longer, and it's not necessarily a compliment. But Irwin's resume, I think, is longer than mine. But then again, he's even older than I am.
I am even older than you, but the difference between my resume and yours in a nutshell is that I've actually done the things that are on my resume.
I see. Giving ammunition to the right. How undisciplined of you. While we're joking around, as Irwin clued me into, this is a sober day. Because we were talking in the late afternoon, and I had not heard about the elementary school shootings in Newtown, Connecticut, 37 miles from where I was raised in North Haven and where my mother still lives. Irwin, Irwin is not a person who's often at a loss for words, but you almost were, as you have to tell me the bare essentials of that story.
Well, it's beyond my capacity to describe or to reason or to articulate. As a father of four and a grandfather of two, I have deluded myself into this almost non-rebuttable presumption that when we send our kids off to school, they're going off to the one place that's as safe a haven as home, maybe even safer than home. And I just can't imagine the pain, the anguish, the everything that these families and this community, and I understand the community is a very closely knit, warm community of people who know one another very well, a community that in recent years was recognized as among the two or three most wonderful places to raise a family in the United States.
Right.
And here these folks sent their kids off to school one morning and just on the eve of the holidays, and we have this, and tragedy is far too meek and far too mild a word to describe it. And once again, we will be in this debate in this country, and hopefully this time that debate will get us somewhere that is beyond the raw politics of are you with me or are you against me, and into the conversation about what we can do to stop this insanity. Twice now this week, earlier in the week in Oregon, today, of course, as you've described it, Steve, not all that long ago, an assault on Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, the Virginia Tech shootings, Columbine, the list seems endless. And as one who has had firsthand experience with family members with mental illnesses,
I understand that this happens at the hands and in the minds of very sick people, but it nonetheless, no matter how heartfelt our understandings are of the people who commit these acts, it doesn't bring back these children, it doesn't bring back these teachers, and this kindergarten teacher whose son apparently lost it today, and with that his taking away not only his mother, but the children that she obviously loved. I have no words.
Very, very sad. We've got two guests joining us here on this Friday night. One of them is a colleague of Irwin's called Elaine Williams, and my understanding she's going to talk about the privatization of the Pennsylvania lottery.
Yes, we've talked about the lottery privatization scam that the corporate administration is trying to unilaterally impose on Pennsylvania a couple of times on this show. Rick with some guests, Rick with me as a guest. Elaine brings a unique perspective to this, and we're going to have a very insightful, I suspect, conversation with Elaine about the legal issues associated with this privatization effort.
Did she file a case today, or?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, we'll find
out.
We'll find out. And then we're also going to talk a little later in the show with Lisa Frank of the Service Employees International Union, the healthcare section of the service workers in Pennsylvania, and she's going to be talking about some battles that are going on in southwestern Pennsylvania with the giant healthcare network, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. There's a couple different dimensions to that. This is a huge, highly profitable, is one way to put it, even though it's a nonprofit network, highly financially successful network of more than 55,000 employees with a CEO that last made over $6 million. But it doesn't pay taxes because it's a nonprofit, and it doesn't pay most of its workers very well. And those are both issues of contention in southwestern Pennsylvania, so Lisa's going to tell us about that. And then we're also going to talk about the passage of the Michigan Right to Work for Less law a couple days ago in the home state of the mighty United Workers Union.
United Auto Workers Union.
Sorry, what did I say?
The United Workers Union.
United Auto Workers Union, sorry, the UAW. And again, I've been wondering about, you know, is this the case of the South Shall Rise Again, sort of the southern anti-union policies moving into the north, a latter-day conservative economist, General Lee, advancing beyond Gettysburg to bring a dagger to the heart of the Union in both senses, the North and its middle class, and a dagger to labor unions in the North? Or is this a last gasp of a spent right-wing movement sneaking through one last punch in the gut for working people in a lame duck legislative session before that right-wing loses the power it would need to do this next year in Michigan's General Assembly? I don't think we know for sure, Irwin, what this is going to be in retrospect, but I actually think it's more of a last gasp.
Well, whether it's a last gasp or a rising curtain over things to come, we don't know, but we do know that our colleagues, our friends, not only in Michigan, but in Ohio and in Pennsylvania, in other states, that the recognition and penetration of unions in the economy is strong, will have to redouble their efforts to make sure it's strong, because we do have a right wing that's emboldened. We can talk about this more later in the show, but there are very scary things happening in the Pennsylvania business community on this issue, even tonight as we speak.
Presumably they are, this has wet their appetite, which is not really a surprise.
Well, their appetite was already wet. Now the juices are dripping from their fangs.
So we'll take a break in a second, and then I think we're going to come back with Elaine after the break. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Republican U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell is advocating cutting Social Security by reducing the annual cost of living adjustment, making you wait until age 67 to get Medicare, and capping Medicaid spending per person per year. All those proposals would hurt working people. The AFL-CIO says the so-called chained CPI Social Security cost of living adjustment change doesn't make it more accurate. It just lowers it for seniors struggling with ever higher prices, including higher health care costs. 250 economists have said there's no empirical basis for changing the Social Security cost of living formula. Raising the age of Medicare eligibility would actually increase the costs of the program, not lower them, and capping Medicaid just shifts the cost to states. For more information on what the proposed Republican cuts would mean for working families, go to aflcio.org/protectourfuture. Republicans at Michigan's legislature are thumbing their noses at voters who rejected emergency financial manager powers in November. Jesse Russell explains.
Emergency financial managers in Michigan could soon have the authority to unilaterally reject or terminate collectively bargained contracts. In November, Michigan voters tossed those powers out when they repealed by ballot PA4, but a brand new emergency financial manager bill passed this week could give those powers back. Republicans argued that the legislation is different from the rejected legislation and that it gives local authorities more of a say. It allows local officials the right to provide input in the decision over choosing an emergency financial manager. Local officials can also remove a manager if two-thirds vote in favor of removal. In the Assembly, one Republican sided with all the Democrats in passing the bill. The legislation that would allow the managers to once again throw out collectively bargained contracts comes on the heels of Michigan Republicans passing a right-to-work state bill, which diminishes the powers of labor organizations to represent workers.
Should the U.S. have universal automatic voter registration? AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka thinks that we should. Trumka says automatic voter registration is already the norm for most of the world's democracies. Trumka says the AFL-CIO and partners like the Brennan Center for Justice, Advancement Project, DEMOS, the NAACP, and the National Council of La Raza, among others, are working together to develop a strategy to achieve universal and automatic voter registration in the U.S. Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show, the voice of working Central Pennsylvania. You're here with co-host Steve Herzenberg, guest hosts Steve Herzenberg and Erwin Aronson. We're going to talk in a second with one of Erwin's colleagues, but very briefly as an intro, what we're going to talk about is the proposed privatization of the Pennsylvania lottery and some of the legal dimensions of that. And just as a point of information, the Keystone Research Center put out a brief on this yesterday, which is online at www.keystoneresearch.org. Unanswered Questions is the name of our brief, that's apropos in part because of the extremely non-transparent way in which this whole lottery privatization proposal has moved forward. But with that background, let me say good evening to Elaine Williams. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us on your Friday night.
Happy to do so.
Okay. Now, you're here, as you know, with your colleague, Erwin, and we'll tag-team this, but mostly I'm going to turn it to him to interrogate you. No, not interrogate you, to lead the questioning.
Sure.
Hello, partner. How are you?
I'm well, Erwin. How are you?
Well, I'm bouncing back. I got my voice back. Elaine was among that great crowd of people earlier today that got to applaud and cheer and clap because I had kind of lost my voice, and it was a blessing to the rest of the world. But good doctors and good drugs, I have it back for the moment. Anyway, Elaine, here in central Pennsylvania, the headline in every edition of the local newspapers and lead stories on every one of the various electronic media outlets is about Governor Corbett privatizing and taking away the jobs of Pennsylvanians who work for the Pennsylvania Lottery. And this has been talked about in other dimensions on this show in the past couple of weeks, but we haven't had the benefit of the real legal underpinnings of this. And let me start by asking, can he do this to us?
Well, we sure don't think so. We believe that the citizens of Pennsylvania elected legislators who more than 30 years ago passed a statute that said that Pennsylvania would in fact have a lottery and that it would be operated by the Department of Revenue. So we believe that absent legislative action, the governor doesn't have the authority to enter into this truly radical minimum of 20-year contract with a private British-based company to operate such an incredibly valuable asset of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Wow, you said so many things, I barely know where to start. The lottery, as I recall, was adopted by the General Assembly through an act sponsored by former Pennsylvania State Senator from Pittsburgh, Frank Mazzei, who was an old friend of mine, actually, is very responsible for getting me through college, having conferred upon me a senatorial scholarship back in the day to get to Penn State University. And that the lottery was created by way of an act of the legislature, of the General Assembly, and was signed into law only after the General Assembly adopted it, then by the governor, Governor Schapp at the time, who signed the law and made it law. Do you have any idea what the basis is upon which this governor, Tom Corbett, believes he can do this?
They have at least suggested in the documents that they have provided, the very limited documents they've provided, because, of course, one of our frustrations here is that there is no transparency and that they will not divulge the underlying documents that they are in discussion with a private company to sign, and they're sort of hiding behind the procurement code on the theory that they don't have to disclose this and therefore they won't. But the limited documents that we have seen, they suggest that because the Secretary of Revenue has the has some discretion to operate the lottery, that discretion extends to his ability to contract the work out entirely to a private operation. And you know, I will tell you that the idea of contracting work out that's currently done by state employees is certainly not a new concept. So you could imagine that there would be areas where PennDOT would decide rather than bringing in equipment operators who are employed by the Commonwealth, they might hire private contractors in a snowstorm to make sure that state roads are plowed. So there has certainly always been a certain amount of contracting of work that's normally done by state employees.
Well, this sounds dramatically different than plowing the snow away from one storm. You said, if I heard you correctly, a 20 to 30 year contract?
The contract that's being proposed is on its face, has a 20 year term, and the contract has specific provisions that if they perform at a certain level, they get to extend the contract for an additional year. So there are some who have suggested that this could potentially be a 30-year contract. And, you know, Erwin, the thing about this that makes me most crazy and most concerned in terms of just general public policy is the lottery generates a vast amount of money for it generates a vast amount of money. I mean, the lottery last year generated, there was $3.4 billion.
That's spent. Billion with a B.
Billion with a B. I've had a hard time with this because I don't usually, my life as a union lawyer, I don't usually speak in terms of billion. But that is, in fact, the case. $3.4 billion. So if you want to put that in perspective, the budget for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is $27 billion. Right? Around 27 billion, mm-hmm. maybe 28.1 or something like that. The budget for the state of Delaware is $3.4 billion. So there is as much money spent on lottery tickets in Pennsylvania as the entire budget for the state of Delaware.
And as I understand things, the lottery is a very successful business that we Pennsylvania taxpayers own and operate. We're shareholders in a very successful business. Isn't that correct?
It is very correct. It is an unbelievably successful business. They are paying less than 1% of their overall operating, of their overall budget is only 1% is spent on employees to operate this incredibly generous, this incredibly huge and successful program.
Can you think of any retail business that we can identify that spends 1% or less on employees, on wages and benefits in the course of its year?
Of course not. It's impossible to think about it. So the way the lottery is structured is citizens buy lottery tickets, so the money comes into the lottery, and then the law says that the lottery is obligated to spend at least 27% of the money that it brings in on programs for senior citizens and the disabled. There was a modification that the number was going to go to 30%, that up to 30% would be spent on that. And then it was rolled back a little bit to 27% for certain kinds of new instant games that they had imposed. But of all the money they bring in, 27% of it goes for benefits, or in this case, Pennsylvania is currently spending 29%.
And those benefits are things like property tax and rent rebates for seniors, transportation for seniors,
it's drug programs
for seniors.
Property tax rebates, it's transportation. Transportation is huge because if you're a senior citizen in Pennsylvania, you can ride public transit for nothing, and the lottery fund reimburses the transit authority. So if you're...
Authorities, by the way, are in terrible economic trouble
They're in horrible economic trouble. So, for example, if you're a senior citizen in the Reading area, you have the right to get on a bus that's operated by BARTA, the transit authority in the Reading area, and that fare... that senior citizen gets to ride for free, and the lottery fund reimburses the transit authority for that person's fare. So,
well, you know, you just raised something that I hadn't really thought of in this context. There are a number of public operating concerns that we taxpayers own. The lottery is one, of course. The wine and spirit shops are another. They're very successful. Those are the ones they propose to sell off. On the other hand, we have SEPTA in Philadelphia, the Port Authority in Allegheny County, Capital Area Transit here in Harrisburg, BARTA in Reading, another one up in Erie, and two in the northeastern
Colts
part of the state.
Lackawanna, yeah, absolutely.
And I don't hear any of the Corbett administration folks suggesting that we sell those off to private enterprise. And indeed, we had historically in this state the experience where all of those transportation systems were at one time private entities, and the privateers ran away from them and left communities high and dry with no transportation. And that was exactly why we have transit authorities in virtually every major urban area in the state.
Absolutely, because private business didn't find it to be lucrative enough to stay in business.
So the deal here is that if it's a loser, Corbett wants us to keep it, and if it's a winner, Corbett wants us to be divested of it. And I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago. You indicated, as I understood what you said, that they are not really telling us citizens what's in the deal. And I recall when Tom Corbett was running for governor of Pennsylvania a few years ago, that he was running under the moniker of Governor Transparency. He committed to us in his campaign the most transparent government Pennsylvania has ever seen. Now, what's going on?
Well, I think that may be what he said, but that certainly has not been the case here. And it's not just that the union is asking, the union that represents the lottery employees is asking what this contract's all about. There are many others who are asking about it, including members of the legislature and members of the elected offices. The treasurer, the auditor general, are asking questions and not getting any answers. And when those questions are posed, the administration is maintaining that it has no obligation to provide the information under the procurement code, which is, you know, one of the statutes that governs how the Commonwealth goes about purchasing services and goods and things of that nature.
Well, how do we deal with the conflict? We have a procurement code that these scoundrels are hiding behind on the one hand, but we also have a right-to-know law in Pennsylvania that says that everything that the government does is specifically required to be shown to us unless there's a protection of it in that law.
Well, there are protections in the right-to-know law for contracts when they have not yet been signed. And so their theory here is this contract has not yet been signed, and until it is signed, we do not have to show you anything. But the problem, of course, is, well, oh, my gosh, how in the world is anybody going to evaluate whether it's a good contract for the state to sign or not sign if no one can see it until after it's signed? It's a sort of Alice in Wonderland kind of world. Trust me, we're going to make an evaluation as to whether it's a good deal. We won't show it to you. We won't show it to the treasurer. We won't show it to the auditor general. We won't show it to the legislature. We won't show it to anyone until after we've signed it, because we don't have to under the right-to-know law or under the procurement code. So, therefore, we won't show it to you. Trust us. We'll do the right thing.
So we don't show you this just because we don't have to?
That's their theory.
Norman, let me jump in here.
Go ahead,
because I'm actually going to wind my way back to a sort of a question to Elaine about what's going to happen on the legal front. Because on the one hand, watching this over the last couple of weeks, the Corbett administration has taken an increasing amount of criticism for both the way they've conducted this process, but also because the basic idea doesn't seem to pass the sniff test. So it seems like a case of bad policy is bad politics. So part of you wonders if at some point they will walk away from this. But having said that, they have been, again, maintaining all along that they have the right to just do this, and they're saying that the offer explodes at the end of December. So maybe they still can intend to follow through with this and put this in place. So what's going to happen on the legal front? Will anyone pursue a case against this before the end of the month, or is it a question of waiting until they actually try to do it and then you pursue the legal case?
Well, I can say that there's certainly consideration that is being the issue of litigation is certainly under consideration by many of the people who are involved and concerned about the privatization of the lottery. It's a difficult and frustrating process to try to make decisions about. Partly, quite frankly, Steve, because we are still so much in the dark as to what it is that's actually going to happen here. Mm-hmm. If in fact the Commonwealth had responded to requests for information that the union that asked me made in a forthcoming manner, you know, one might be in a position to be able to make an evaluation as to whether this subcontracting made sense. You might not like it, but at least, you know, you could at least evaluate the merits of it, the lack of information has caused everyone great concern. So there is certainly consideration underway with regards to challenging the actions of the Commonwealth to try to subcontract this, privatize this incredibly valuable asset of the state. The final decisions have not yet been made. It has been suggested, although of course no one has seen this, that Camelot has said its bid will expire on December 31st.
Camelot is the sole bidder to this solicitation that the governor.
Right, they're the British company that wants to take over the operation of the lottery. I find it, again, fairly bizarre that, again, you have this $3.4 billion entity and there's only one bidder, and how convenient that the bidder did business with the private equity company that was hired to evaluate the bids, but setting that aside for a moment.
So we have a conflict of interest kind of ethics act issue here, as well as the right to know law, as well as this notion of separate powers between legislative and executive branch of government.
Yeah, but we don't know whether there's an ethics violation or not, but we know that raises some questions.
Well, there is that old saw about when it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck and it quacks like a duck. Maybe it's a duck.
Certainly true.
And that's, and again, at least to this layperson, the conflict of interest you just laid out, that is the fact that the Commonwealth's privatization advisor has a very cozy...
And that's called Greenhill & Company,
Greenhill
is that right?
Company, yeah. The fact that they have a very cozy relationship with the only bidder, because they guided that company to its current owner,
mm-hmm.
right? And they made a boatload of money.
Well, that's my understanding, yeah.
That's right. That's what the press has reported.
Yeah.
But that cozy relationship, that element of crony capitalism, if you will... to me, at least, seems like the least glaring of the two extremely glaring conflicts of interest. The other conflict of interest is, again, this is a case where when you look at the specifics of this idea from a policy point of view, you as you two have just laid out, really, you're struggling to figure out why would one do this. It has low administrative costs. Actually, if you compare Pennsylvania with other states, other lotteries, we have relatively low, lower than most other states.
The fact of the matter is, as you look around Pennsylvania, we have the lowest administrative costs on any state.
On government generally.
On government state employees anyway.
Absolutely. It is enormously profitable. There is, unlike the case where wine and spirit stores, there's some sentiment among the consumer public, even though we don't agree with that proposal, there is some consumer sentiment for privatization. There is no public sentiment for privatization. In this case, no one in the legislature wanted to do this. The only people who seem to want to do this is, the corporate administration wants to do it, but the financial interest of their privatization advisor is in doing this. They get, today's press reports are $30 to $50 million if this goes through.
And isn't it interesting that they said they couldn't reveal any of this information, but when the report, when one suggestion came out that they would make $30 million, they said, oh, well, no, they'll only make $30 million. They won't make 50.
Right.
We found a loophole in the procurement code so we can at least reveal this part of the contract to show you that they'll only make $30 million as opposed to $50 million if this deal goes
through. And this is $30 million to basically a gatekeeper.
A private equity company.
That produced nothing, not one job, and in fact takes
Bain Capital. But a company like Bain Capital.
I mean, this is an amount of work. The Keystone Research Center did it. Maybe a couple hundred thousand dollars. Maybe.
Well, their role here really is like the marriage broker from Fiddler on the Roof. They're bringing two parties together, producing nothing, taking away jobs.
Well, and they're taking a dowry.
You certainly see why they want this deal to go through. If you were going to make $30 million by December 31st, wouldn't you want to make the deal go through?
And I guess that they really have a rush to judgment on that $30 million because after the first of the year, when we fall off the fiscal cliff, they might actually have to pay tax on it.
And how much of that will come back to the Corbyn administration and political contributions for the next election? I mean, this is just about as smelly as politics gets.
Well, from Governor Transparency, yeah. Wow. And let me go back to something. You alluded to the idea that PennDOT, other agencies of state government, contract out some forms or some aspects of their work.
Absolutely.
This is not contracting out an aspect of the work. This is contracting away our ownership interest in this very successful enterprise. But does the collective bargaining agent, the representative of the workers of the lottery, have any collective bargaining language upon which they may rely?
The union that represents the lottery employees is AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And, in fact, they do have contractual language that gives them the right to challenge the subcontracting. It's not the strongest language in the world, but it's language that at least creates a process whereby the employer must establish the reason, the rationale for subcontracting the work, and provide the union with all of the information it has, the Commonwealth has available to it, and then the union has an opportunity to present alternative methods for providing the services, and then a decision is made as to whether the contract is going to go forward or not, and the union has the right to challenge that in arbitration. So where the union is right now in the process is they have notified, the Commonwealth notified the union on November 20th that it was going to subcontract. There was a meeting that occurred, I want to say, around November 28th between the parties with regards to their desire to subcontract. There were many questions asked, most of which the Commonwealth could not answer. And subsequently, the union submitted a request for information on December 6th. To the Commonwealth for additional information. That request for information was responded to on, I want to say, Wednesday of this week. So that would have been the
12th.
11th, I think. 12th. I don't know what Wednesday was.
The 12th.
2 days ago.
Yeah. It would be the 12th.
12th. And that information was incomplete. They didn't give the union all the information it was seeking. In fact, hiding again once again behind the procurement code.
Well, how do they reconcile again this conflict of laws? They're hiding behind the procurement code and using that to evade the right to know law. Now they're hiding behind the procurement code and using that as a method by which to evade their collective bargaining obligations, which are covered by the public employee relations law.
Would that
be an unfair labor practice, possibly?
We think that it is an unfair labor practice. And so there's, we think that they have an obligation to provide the union with all of the information the union reasonably needs. The union has a reasonable belief that it needs to be able to enforce its collective bargaining agreement and to represent the employees in its bargaining unit. And it's a pretty broad standard, and certainly the information that the Commonwealth has presented does not meet that criteria. So the union is considering its options with regards to that. But it is, one of the really significant issues here is the union has specifically asked the Commonwealth whether it has, it has made the statement that Camelot's bid only stays open until December 31st of 2012. And we have specifically asked them, have you asked Camelot, will you extend that, extend their bid for another 30 days? I mean, this is a fairly outrageous rush to judgment. I mean, the public wasn't told about this until November 20th, and they plan on doing all of it by December 31st. So it's,
and I think we need to remember as well that the General Assembly expired, if you will, on November 30th at the end of its legislative session. So this sounds as if it was time to assure that it could only happen when the General Assembly, for all practical purposes,
didn't exist and wasn't in Harrisburg.
It certainly does. And, oh, by the way, at this time of the year, we do seem to have a number of religious and familial and cultural holidays that interfere with people's ability to pay close attention to what's going on. So it's almost, I mean,
You just raised another thought for me as well. Aren't we just about to get a new attorney general to replace Corbett's appointee into that spot who might have
an
interest in reviewing this?
We certainly are. She takes office on the new attorney general will be sworn into office on January 15th. The legislature reconvenes in January as well.
January 2nd, I believe.
And so all of these actions are being taken after the legislature has adjourned, while you have an appointed attorney general who's clearly a lame duck. It's a very questionable use of resources. But the point I'm trying to make is, or the point I wanted to make was that, we have asked specifically whether they would extend this bid, and they will not answer that question. They won't even answer the question as to whether they have asked whether Camelot will extend its bid until, say, January 30th. Their only response is, we're not obligated to give you that information under the procurement code, preposterous.
Well, beyond being preposterous, we have this need to reconcile things. How can the union determine whether or not it has rights under its subcontracting clause in the contract to which you referred, if they can't get the information necessary to make that determination? And this rush to judgment seems to be happening almost in the same fashion that the waves come up on the shore every moment of every day as the ocean exists.
Very good question, Erwin. And it cannot be reconciled, and they won't provide the information, and the union is completely hamstrung in its ability to present alternatives.
So it sounds like the union is exploring a few paths here based on what you've discussed with us in our short interview. Are there others beyond the union, beyond AFSCME, that are looking at this as well?
There certainly are. I mean, you know, there is no question, but as we said when we began the conversation, the lottery is a product of legislation. It was created by the legislature. The legislature specified that there shall be a lottery and what the lottery shall consist of, and that it will be operated by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. If, in fact, Pennsylvania is going to cede the authority of this lottery to a private entity, we believe that that can only be done by action of the legislature. And there are any number of legislators who are very concerned with the governor's attempt to usurp the powers of the legislative branch. And as you know, anyone who took civics know, we have three branches of government in the Commonwealth, and the executive cannot exceed their authority to invade the powers of the legislative branch. So we believe, and a number of legislators believe very strongly, that the actions of the Commonwealth violate separation of powers. Legislators are contemplating litigation as well.
I see. Very significant, because this is the same Governor Transparency that keeps telling us about how there's too much government and there's too much government influence and too much government penetration into our daily lives. And it sounds, from what you've described, almost as if this governor has decided to not only use the authority of his own high office, but to steal the authority of a co-equal branch of government and put it in his pocket after having waited till they left town to do so.
Well, it's a pretty interesting theory that they're espousing. But I will tell you one thing about Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a very well-established body of law respecting the authority of each branch of government. The executive clearly has its powers, the legislature has its powers, and the judiciary certainly has its powers. And I find this grab, if you will, to be pretty extreme, and very much out of the norm. And I don't exactly understand the rationale supporting why it is these actions are being taken, because it would seem to me that if, in fact, the governor thinks this is the appropriate thing to do, given that his party controls both the House and the Senate, he would go to the leaders of the House and the Senate and say, I think we ought to amend the Lottery Act to provide for this. And then, of course, we would all be arguing about whether that was a correct policy decision or not. But at least it would be a decision made by elected representatives as opposed to the executive branch.
Yeah.
It is very curious to me that rather than going to the legislature to, again, both houses in control by the party, by the Republicans, that he's taking this action, you know, he's out there as a single agent, a lone agent.
The Lone Ranger.
Yeah, it is very perplexing and very surprising and very disturbing.
Yeah, well, very disturbing indeed, and Steve alluded to this, as I've learned over too many years, these kinds of things happen when one gets the opportunity to follow the money trail. I'm also intrigued, one of these other little things that, you know, you pick up over the course of a career, Pennsylvania was among the first, if not the first, of the several states to adopt in the 1800s a legislative article in its state constitution in order to enshrine the separation of powers and establish not only the power of the General Assembly, but the process by which bills become law and how laws are adopted. And other states have taken the extraordinary step over the subsequent years after Pennsylvania adopted that to adopt almost verbatim Pennsylvania's legislative constitution article.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are having one of our own homegrown stealing, if you will of the people to behind closed doors, pocket this particular power. If the governor can do this with respect to the lottery, can he do it with respect to the wine and spirit shops? Can he do it with respect to our children's schools? Can he do it with respect to our highways and roads? Can he do it with respect to our prisons?
Well, you know, certainly when Dick Thornburgh was governor, as he was leaving office, literally an act of a lame duck legislature,
governor,
he attempted to privatize the liquor stores by issuing an executive order. I don't know if you remember this, Irwin. It happened in,
I remember it.
1982.
It happened. It was 1982. It was my very first oral argument before the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court.
Yeah. And the court, you know, clearly trounced him and said, you don't have the power to do this, my friend. If you want to attempt to privatize liquor stores, you have to go to the legislature. You know, you're the governor. You get to enforce the laws that have been enacted, but last time we looked, you don't get to write the statute.
Yeah. Intriguing. Well, it sounds like there's a great deal more to come, and thank you for all of your work and for the work of our mutual colleagues at WWD. And on behalf of all of our listeners and the several hundred good AFSCME members who happen to work for the Pennsylvania Lottery directly or indirectly, we're going to keep our eyes open and watch for what happens next with bated breath to see how Governor Transparency gets dealt with.
It's going to be an exciting couple of weeks.
Indeed, it sounds like that. Thanks, Elaine, and apologies to that guy you hang out with who's probably in the background there for us interrupting your Friday night and your weekend.
No, he's I can hear him laughing in the other room with his colleagues. So not to worry. They won't even know that I've been missing.
Good deal.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners tonight, and I'm so glad you're feeling better and have a voice.
Yeah, I think you say that with tongue in cheek. There's so many people in our firm who are happy that I don't have one or when I didn't. But thanks again, and hopefully you'll be kind enough to grace us with your presence and give us a follow-up when we get to talk about this.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Elaine. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I think we got about 4 minutes before we 3 minutes before we take a break. So, I want to walk through quickly the arguments we laid out, some of which we've covered in the policy brief we did on this yesterday. But again, I've been feeling that this is a little bit like T-ball or softball for six-year-olds in the sense that it's a case of eight strikes and you're out, right? So only one bid, which you guys talked about, just as when a homeowner hires a roofing contractor, getting only one bid is a red flag that you're about to get fleeced. The conflict of interest that you talked about with the state's privatization advisor. Another issue that you, our brief talks about is that the promised profits from the contractor would rise only at the rate of inflation. If you look over the
whole... Well, but be careful. We're not talking about promised profits.
Yeah,
there's a promise of profits to the vendor, to the contractor. All there is to us is a promise of income based on the cost of living.
Well, so
that we can learn about.
But, the contractor promises certain amounts of revenue, sort of, and which you can compare with the current revenue. And if you look... So they're basically saying something about how much, again, I'm still inclined to use the word lottery profits will grow. But the point for the audience, Irwin, is that the promises they're making in terms of guaranteed, quote, revenues,
are
very modest. They are, every indication is that they will be able to expand lottery games. To include Keno and to include online gaming.
But understand that there's nothing that prohibits the lottery in its present construct.
No, absolutely. I get that.
From expanding the game.
I get it. But what I'm just trying to get to for people is that they're not committed to make ambitious targets is the real point. So,
well, it goes beyond that, and this is an important point. When we take this very successful business that is owned by the citizens of Pennsylvania, and we transfer its operation to this private entity, what we do immediately is strip the citizens of Pennsylvania from their right to secure the profit from this statutorily created monopoly. Okay, there's only one lottery in Pennsylvania. There's only one legally permissible lottery in Pennsylvania. We created it, we own it, the General Assembly adopted it, and now we are transferring the only absolutely certain benefit of it, the unlimited profit potential, into the hands of some privateer and relegating the citizens of Pennsylvania to a formula that is anything but ambitious, anything but decent, anything but real, not connected to the operational income of the lottery, not connected to the administrative expense of the lottery, which will go up, not down, by the way, but instead connected only to inflation. And we all know that the one thing that hasn't grown in the last several years is inflation. But they're tying this to the Consumer Price Index. Indeed, the report came out today, as you as an economist saw this before I did, that the CPI actually went down from last month to this month.
So
we are losing the most precious aspect of that asset, one that one would think a great privateer like Governor Corbett would subscribe to, that is the profit potential. We are giving it away.
Right. This is not a good deal economically for the Commonwealth. In the most likely range of revenues, the company would get half any increase in revenues, most of which would result from expanding the games allowed by the lottery.
And we don't even know that because they haven't revealed it. We got to go to a break.
So we are taking a break. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Republican U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell is advocating cutting Social Security by reducing the annual cost of living adjustment, making you wait until age 67 to get Medicare, and capping Medicaid spending per person per year. All those proposals would hurt working people. The AFL-CIO says the so-called chained CPI Social Security cost of living adjustment change doesn't make it more accurate. It just lowers it for seniors struggling with ever higher prices, including higher health care costs. 250 economists have said there's no empirical basis for changing the Social Security cost of living formula. Raising the age of Medicare eligibility would actually increase the costs of the program, not lower them, and capping Medicaid just shifts the cost to states. For more information on what the proposed Republican cuts would mean for working families, go to AFLCIO.org/protectourfuture. Republicans at Michigan's legislature are thumbing their noses at voters who rejected emergency financial manager powers in November. Jesse Russell explains.
Emergency financial managers in Michigan could soon have the authority to unilaterally reject or terminate collectively bargained contracts. In November, Michigan voters tossed those powers out when they repealed by ballot PA4, but a brand new emergency financial manager bill passed this week could give those powers back. Republicans argued that the legislation is different from the rejected legislation and that it gives local authorities more of a say. It allows local officials the right to provide input in the decision over choosing an emergency financial manager. Local officials can also remove a manager if two-thirds vote in favor of removal. In the assembly, one Republican sided with all the Democrats in passing the bill. The legislation that would allow the managers to once again throw out collectively bargained contracts comes on the heels of Michigan Republicans passing a right-to-work state bill, which diminishes the powers of labor organizations to represent workers.
Should the U.S. have universal automatic voter registration? AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka thinks that we should. Trumka says automatic voter registration is already the norm for most of the world's democracies. Trumka says the AFL-CIO and partners like the Brennan Center for Justice, Advancement Project, DEMOS, the NAACP, and the National Council of La Raza, among others, are working together to develop a strategy to achieve universal and automatic voter registration in the U.S. Workers Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about the potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money. Even if it has been money for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You're listening to co-hosts, co-guest hosts, Erwin Aronson from Williams and Davidson. He seems to be getting his voice back, unfortunately. And this is Steve Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center. I could have sworn that I'm told that clip was Ron Paul talking about the gold standard. I thought it was Woody Allen.
No, it was Ron Paul. This was when he made his 1842 remarks.
Well, I think he's almost as funny as Woody Allen.
Yeah.
And makes about as much sense.
Well, Woody Allen fortunately does make sense, and Ron Paul has yet to make sense to me.
Maybe he's living in his own real-life version of Sleeper.
And then, of course, we have his son, Rand Paul, who is a United States senator and a legend in his own mind himself.
So I'm just going to wrap up the lottery thing, beating a dead horse, perhaps. But before the break, we're partly talking about the fact that the Commonwealth is getting a good deal in terms of increases in revenue that the state couldn't get all on its own. But the contractor is getting a good deal by our estimates, which are conservative. The contractor over 20 years could potentially get over $1 billion that would otherwise go to programs for seniors. And again, one of the questions that we raise in our brief unanswered questions is, what's the return on investment for the contractor? So if they're making $1 billion, one of the questions is, what's the contractor investing? like almost nothing, as far as I can tell. I mean, they have a little.
Well, we do have that $30 to $50 million that their agent is going to get.
But that's that comes off.
And I suspect that if we just peel the onion a little bit, we'll find out that the taxpayers of Pennsylvania who are losing their precious asset or losing control over it and losing its income-generating potential are probably the ones that are paying the 30 to 50, not Camelot.
I feel confident that you are right on that.
And every time I hear the name of this contractor, I start breaking into song, and I think of Richard Harris and the Knights of the Table Round, who are invincible.
Indeed. So again, if they're making $1 billion, and you know, then at best the amount of money they're putting into this is measured in the tens of millions of dollars. This is one of the best investment deals I've ever heard of.
Well, from a raw investment perspective, this is illustrative, if you will, of something that has been happening in this country for several years. It used to be that capitalists invested in bricks and mortar, in technology, in building railroads and erecting steel mills and digging coal out of the ground. And hopefully after a substantial investment and a commitment of capital and a commitment to paying labor at some rate, if they were really industrious and had a really good idea and worked really hard, they would make some money. Now we have this new era where they invest very little money in buying themselves a few politicians. And if they score, they score really well. This guy Adelson, who invested $100 million from his gambling operations, that are a gamble for everybody but him, in electoral politics in this most recent election cycle, stood to have really won, imagine what I'm going to tell you next, $100 million investment nationwide would have had Romney been elected instead of President Obama, would have yielded, based upon the Romney-Ryan tax plan, a $2 billion, with a B again, dollar return. Now, there is no business, other than maybe stealing the Pennsylvania lottery, where you can get those kinds of ratios. So, of course, they did that. And, of course, Camelot, through its agent, what's that company called again? Green Hill Investment?
Green Hill Company, yes.
Green Hill Company.
Through Green its Acres, agent. No.
Do-do-do-do.
No, it's paper entrepreneurialism, but you're exactly right. There's actually political science research recently, which shows, unfortunately, that the return to lobbying, the financial return to paying off politicians in more and less subtle ways is phenomenal.
And we're seeing this every day. I wish that I could tell you that it only is happening with respect to the Pennsylvania lottery. It's been happening with our public schools in this state for nearly two decades.
Yep.
These charter operators who are privateers putting taxpayer money from our local communities that's supposed to do one of the most effective and valuable things for our society, that is educate our children. And instead of investing and spending the money on education, they're pocketing the money. And amazingly enough, the so-called venture capitalists and the so-called hedge fund managers are investing very, very heavily, in relative terms, in schools and charter schools because they again see this extraordinary return on investment compared to doing something that actually requires work.
Right. So the good old days were when, you know, you had Andrew Carnegie at least ran a steel company. Henry Ford at least was an innovator. No.
Imagine that we have reached this point in our lives where we look to the Henry Clay Fricks, Carnegies,
the robber barons.
The robber barons are looking better and better. You know, at least we saw where they were doing the steel.
The very last thing I promise, audience, on this lottery stuff is, who's done this? Well, two states have done this, but Indiana has done it too recently to have any information.
Illinois
did it a couple years ago. And when you go back and look at the press stories on this, it's definitely from the you cannot invent this stuff school. The Illinois contracting. There was a grotesque conflict of interest on the front end. That is, the winning contractor there gave massive amounts of money to the governor that oversaw the original.
Do you remember that governor's name?
Was that him? No.
Do you know where he's living now?
Was it?
It was he.
I'm not.
It was he.
Are you sure the timing's right? I'm not sure it is, but
it was
what's his name? It begins with B, right? What's his name?
Blagojevich.
Blagojevich. I'm not, well, speaking of for sale, but I'm, well, we can leave aside whether or not that's the right governor or not, but so again, massive political contributions, then you get the contract. Strangely enough, they've actually managed to perform poorly enough that they haven't met what I presume were not ambitious targets in that case either. And now they're in court or in a legal dispute with...
No, now they're in court. Now they've gotten to court. But the imagine this. Go back to what Elaine was talking about in terms of the legalities of this transaction. Well, in Illinois, one of the little other legalities beyond... the commingling, if you will, the inappropriate commingling of legislative and executive duties. The state of Illinois and this contractor actually entered into a written agreement. Excuse me. The contractor has now defaulted to the tune of $35 million that the contract that they entered into required them to pay, and they haven't paid, and they're suggesting that the state of Illinois now does not have a right to enforce that. Now imagine this multi-billion dollar entity, Camelot, defaulting on a contract that can't be revealed because the procurement code trumps the right to know law and the collective bargaining agreement and the public employee relations law in Pennsylvania, according to the Corbettites. Imagine, if you will, a couple of years down the road in the second Corbett administration after which they are lusting desperately, that Camelot says, oh, well, gee, folks, we ain't going to pay. Now, if we have a sweetheart deal going in, is it going to be the same Corbett administration that chases Camelot? Or maybe they'll chase Greenhill, that $30 to $50 million. That sounds an awful lot like the amount of default in Illinois. Let's get real here, folks.
Now, the legal wrangling in Illinois about the contractor compensating the state for failure to meet revenue targets, it really does give you a sense that if by some miracle the contractor managed to miss the revenue targets here in Pennsylvania, we wouldn't actually get compensated for it. So it's why, you know, in our view, the contractor on the one hand could make $1 billion and on the other hand won't compensate the state fully if they do badly. So that's why this is a heads the contractor wins, tails the Commonwealth loses deal. Bottom line, stick a fork in it, please.
Yeah, it's done. Well, our listeners need to call, email, fax the governor's office and really make it clear that we're very concerned about this. We're offended by it. We're troubled by it. And we're troubled by it not only because of what we think it is, because we really don't know, but because it's being done under cover of darkness by Governor Transparency. And we need to speak up and speak out. I recall from some years ago the dramatic words of a United States senator from the state of Illinois and former Republican floor leader in the United States Senate, Everett McKinley Dirksen, when Dirksen said, a billion here and a billion there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money.
Crony capitalism Camelot, and there's a fourth C in there somewhere. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and talk to Lisa Frank from the Service Employees International Union about UPMC in southwestern Pennsylvania. Stay with us. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
America. Rick Smith.
Are you a fashionista? Do you live for shoes? Is style your middle name? If you have experienced any of the following symptoms: crying, anxiousness, fits of worry, sleeplessness, card cutting, bill shredding, high interest rising balances, and repeated general avoidance, you are in luck. We can help. And the best part? Saving never goes out of style. Transfer your high interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate, good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Big news, holiday travelers. American Airlines has a new family deal for you. If you and the kids are headed off to Grandma's house or wherever, American will seat you together. Well, yes, airlines have always done this, but the new part in American's family deal is this. You pay a fee for it. Being seated together is no longer a gracious service, but a calculated nickel-and-dime opportunity for the corporation to squeeze you. American calls this rip-off seat reservations, $25 each way. Of course, paying this corporate tax doesn't guarantee that your seats will actually stay attached to the plane. American, you might recall, had a rash of flights grounded in October due to the rather startling in-flight experience of passenger seats suddenly coming loose. At the time, the airline's executives rushed to suggest that disgruntled unions were behind this odd malfunction. Well, no. Internal documents have now revealed that the sabotage came right out of the executive suite. Having ordered a revised seating plan so they could charge additional fees for a bit of extra legroom, the geniuses at the top then tried to get the reinstallations done on the cheap. Rather than having their own highly skilled and experienced mechanics do the work, they outsourced it to low-wage non-union contractors. They, in turn, quote, misinterpreted American's maintenance manual, did incorrect installations of seats, and even had students doing some of the installations. Incredibly, American's hierarchy resorted to cold corporate think to rationalize their shoddy management. Our competitors do maintenance where it is most cost-effective, they explain, so we must similarly adapt. This is Jim Hightower saying, cost-effective? Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell another fee coming on. You want safety? Hey, there's a fee for that.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
And the radio is in the hands of such a lot of fools trying to anesthetize the way that you
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Irwin Aronson.
I'm Stephen Hertzenberg, and that was Elvis Costello.
Yes.
So we're going to talk now to Lisa Frank. Good evening, Lisa.
Hey.
Lisa is with the Service Employees International Union, the Healthcare Pennsylvania section of that union.
And watch what you say here, Hertzenberg, because I'm a 40-year member of SEIU, and my dues are current.
Wow. I always watch what I say, Owen.
So do we.
Discipline is my middle name. So
that's why you were on time tonight for the first time in I don't know how long.
I was early, please. Lisa, we're going to talk with you about UPMC, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, this huge healthcare network in anchored in southwestern Pennsylvania, but now spread, I know, all the way up to Erie, as well as points east and west and south of Pittsburgh. 55,000 employees plus 36,000 in Metro Pittsburgh, a so-called non-profit network that has grown over the past two decades. And Lisa, UPMC is facing some scrutiny now on a couple of different grounds. So you want to sort of tell people what those are?
Sure. I think, you know, the way I think of the conversation that's happening in Pittsburgh is, you know, that it's really part of a conversation that I think we see happening in lots of places. Greece, you know, but, you know, over the last year and even in the recent election, you know, people, Americans all over the place really kind of waking up to the levels of income inequality that are happening and that, you know, have been kind of happening over the last 30 years and, you know, noticing the effects of that, noticing the effects of really, you know, far too much political power, far too much economic power concentrated in the hands of far too few people. And we're feeling it in our pocketbooks. We're feeling it in our, you know, democracy. We're feeling it all over the place. And, you know, as people, you know, we saw fast food workers go on strike in New York. We saw people in Chicago and the Miracle Mile, you know, start to talk about what's going on in the growing sectors of our economy. You know, similarly here in Pittsburgh, folks are looking at the largest employer, the largest landowner, just take a step back. You know, Pittsburgh is known for steel, and you know, we had steel mills here long before we had middle-class jobs here.
That's S-T-E-E-L.
That stuff, right? Ingots and stuff like that. And, you know, and it's a similar kind of thing. You know, in the late 19th century and early 20th century and then a little bit later in the 20th century, folks, the people who worked in the mills, the people who sold stuff to the people who worked in the mills, the elected officials who looked after the people who worked in the mills, you know, kind of looked around and said, hey, you know, it's not right that the central industry in our economy is turning a lot of steel and turning out a lot of wealth for very few people, but not turning out all that much for anybody else. And, you know, folks figured out ways to get their arms around that and to fix it. UPMC in so many ways has replaced the steel industry, you know, 36,000 people. The Homestead Works, I think at its height, employed about 30,000 folks. UPMC has moved right into the steel tower, you know, took down the U.S. Steel logo and put their logo right up on the tower. So, you know, in almost every way you can think of, as replacing steel, UPMC becoming the largest employer instead of U.S. Steel, you know, even their very location downtown, you know, that's what we're looking at. And the healthcare industry is cranking out a lot of jobs, but not a lot of family-sustaining jobs, and so people are starting to look at that.
Right, and now clearly at the very top, I mean, even though UPMC is called a nonprofit, at the very top, UPMC pays very well.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the very top, it pays very well. Jeffrey Romoff made about $6 million.
We don't know what he made. We know what he was paid.
Right. and, you know, that there was a little survey that was put out by one of the, you know, kind of newspapers, I guess, or more like trade magazines for the not-for-profit world. And, you know, that makes him the second best, highest earning, you know, not-for-profit hospital CEO in the country. You know, more than, the Cleveland Clinic or the, you know, Mayo Clinic or Johns Hopkins or, you know, any of those places, you know, sometimes by a factor of two or three or even five. And the next 22 well-paid people, you know, make over $1 million apiece. So it is possible to do very well working for this health system, and it's possible to do not so well.
Right, so and I think it's important to point out, being a Pittsburgher by birth, I know a bit of this history. UPMC is an outgrowth of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, and it was very much an ancillary minor piece of the medical school in my lifetime, as recently as 25 mm-hmm. years ago, 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and now it has become this monopoly, if you will,
on the delivery of healthcare systems to people of all levels of means in southwestern Pennsylvania and even in northwestern Pennsylvania. And this is the tail now that seems to wag the dog, if I understand things correctly.
Well, you actually hit on a number of things that I think are sort of significant about this institution. It doesn't quite have a monopoly. I think right now UPMC has, I don't know, 60, maybe a little bit, 55% or something of the acute care market. But it is certainly in its business plan to become a monopoly. We have a, you know, a competing health system, the West Penn Allegheny Health System here in Pittsburgh, and you know, without wanting to bore your listeners entirely, you know, UPMC has spent the last kind of couple of years maneuvering to, you know, to really drive that system out of business. They, you know, set up a kind of unneeded competing hospital in Monroeville. You know, there's right next to the competitor's hospital, and there's the whole kind of Highmark struggle that, you know, people probably aren't paying very much attention to if you don't live in Pittsburgh, but, you know, to help kind of stabilize the competing system financially, UPMC is looking for a divorce from Highmark, which is the largest insurer in this area, but there's about 3 million covered lives, and, you know, it's recently become inconvenient for UPMC to have to, you know, bargain rates, which are already the highest, you know, in the region and in some cases the highest in the country, with a large insurer. They would prefer to have many small insurers in the market and have been, you know, as I said, kind of looking to divorce Highmark and certainly to prevent Highmark from helping to stabilize the other health system. So there's a big battle around that going on. And like I said, I don't want to bore your listeners with all the details, but the point is that, you know, UPMC is definitely looking to be a monopoly provider, and that's got a lot of people, you know, a little bit frightened.
You know, you make me wonder where the ghost of Teddy Roosevelt is, but and it sort of is stunning.
And he was a Republican.
No, but no, where's the trust busters when you need them? And it's also a little bit stunning that they, you'd think they'd be aware that they might be overreaching, but you don't get the sense that they are aware of that.
Well, I think, you know, Rick sort of made a point. You know, it takes folks a while. You know, I was actually at this hearing that you spoke about, which happened maybe about a week ago, December 5th, and, you know, a lot of folks came out. The county council had a hearing to, you know, kind of talk about the institution, and you know, it's a big institution in Pittsburgh, and there's a lot to talk about, and a lot of people came.
And this was a hearing over the property tax issue as it applies to UPMC, correct?
Right. Well, it's really about their tax-exempt status, you know, which certainly entails property taxes, but, you know, tax exemption, there's a lot of taxes. And, you know, so folks came down to talk about that. And, you know, What I was struck by was one of the people who spoke, you know, was really talking a little bit about the history of the institution and indeed the history of hospitals. And, you know, it takes a while, I think, for, you know, elected leaders and regulators and whatnot to catch up with what, you know, economic entities do in, you know, a fairly dynamic economic system like ours. And I don't think when people, you know, invented not-for-profits or created the regulations around not-for-profits, they were really imagining anything like this entity. You know, they were thinking about, you know, charitable institutions that were run by, you know, little nuns and offshoots of churches. And, you know, that's really where it began. And so it's not surprising, right? It's not surprising that regulators have, you know, it's taken them a while to figure it out because, you know, in 1996, you know, as early as or as recently as that, you know, UPMC was like one hospital, WPIC, or, you know, it was not a healthcare land empire the way it is now.
Right.
So, no, we got to invent systems of accountability for entities that, you know, we've really never seen before.
No, you're right. We're only 10 years from an age where most hospitals were community hospitals.
Right.
So you're right. It's a brave new world of healthcare. Just one.
UPMC is a far cry from the Sisters of Christian Charity.
Correct.
So one thing, Lisa. You're not going in and out. You're fine, but you are going a little softer at times. So I'm guessing that you're moving away from your phone a little bit occasionally. So just FYI. I want to come back to really their impact on jobs. And again, come back to the sort of analogy you made with the steel industry and how we created the middle class in the first place. So we talked about how UPMC at the top end pays at the top end. But when it comes to the core of its workforce and particularly sort of the lower paid entry-level workers, despite its power, despite its wealth, it doesn't seem to be the pace setter when it comes to wages, right?
No, and in fact, it doesn't have any real intention of being the pace setter. There's a little, I don't know if it's a flyer or a handout or something that's been kind of circulating around where, management states quite clearly, if you come to Pittsburgh, you'll see all over the city, UPMC, number one in heart transplants and number one in geriatric this, and it was number one in everything. They're just emblazoned all over the city, land in the airport. And but it's sort of ironic kind of funny to see, this little document floating around this. We have no intention of being number one in wages. We have an intention. We're going to benchmark ourselves, kind of at the median for.
So where's the billboard that says number one in exploitation of its workers?
that could even sound reasonable to you. Well, why shouldn't they pay in the middle? Except when you have an institution that is as big as UPMC, they're not just any player, right, in the wage mart, they're the wage setter. What they do is going to dictate to some extent what happens at McDonald's or what happens at Michael's or what happens at nursing homes or what happens in, those places in the same way that steel did that. Steel wage jobs became good jobs when auto jobs became good jobs, when, the jobs in the dominant entities and the dominant sector of the economy become good jobs, then all jobs become good jobs. That's how all boats rise. Well, similarly, if they remain crappy jobs, then all boats sink.
Right. So, I mean, I think one thing that's been wonderful and educational about the way that you folks are trying to have this conversation is that you're beginning to paint a picture for people, kind of a what if, right? So if UPMC's entry-level wages went from, around $10 an hour, maybe now, if we're lucky, to like $15 an hour, in one fell swoop, because of the impact of that on the broader healthcare sector and the broader service sector, you really go a long way to getting back a middle class in southwestern Pennsylvania.
And that's right. I think that's right. And, we're helping to paint that picture, but the truth is everybody's painting that picture. I mean, it is so clear to folks that, the difficulties that people in Pittsburgh have and, in the region have, have everything to do with the loss of middle-class jobs. And, it's not that hard for people to picture what would happen if folks had middle-class jobs again, because, they can remember, their parents can remember, when ordinary people, could get by and, really live without fear of what's going to happen between this paycheck and next paycheck. There's been a little bit of a controversy over the last few days. One of the folks who works at UPMC who came down to testify at this hearing told her story, and she talked about the food bank that, as I now understand it, the idea seemed to have come from some employees at Mercy, which is one of UPMC's hospitals, and then it kind of got picked up, I think, by management and moved into, I'm not exactly sure how the idea spread, but this particular worker was approached by her manager, and her manager said, you know, we've been listening to, you know, everything you've been saying about how difficult it is to make ends meet and whatnot, and we want you to know that this new food bank for you here. And, you know, she was upset by that, partly because she didn't want to talk to her manager about her financial situation particularly, you know, and partly because, you know, it's sort of an upsetting thing. I mean, it just makes people mad and upset that they work really hard every day and they still need a food bank.
Right.
So she told that story, and I don't think anybody intended for it to become a big story, but it became a big story. the city paper picked up on it, and then the Post-Gazette picked up on it, and then the whatever picked up on it, you know, it's kind of going around the interwebs, as we say now. And, you know, it's really interesting to see how people are responding to that and just how, you know, instinctive it is for people to say, wait, hold up. Somebody works all day, you know, puts in a good day's work, does important work. We assume it's important work. You know, UKMC doesn't keep people around who are not pulling their weight. So obviously doing something to advance the delivery of healthcare, you know, doing a decent job at it because she's still doing it and, you know, needs to use a food bank. You know, there was a man who testified about how, you know, he hasn't bought his wife a Christmas present in a couple of years. And, you know, people get that and they know it's not right.
Right.
Oh, and they know that their cost of health care continues to go up exponentially, and they don't understand why or where it's going, I suspect.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. It really is about priorities, right? I mean, healthcare is what as a percent of our GDP. It's a lot, like 12 or 13, 16.
Yeah,
I can't remember, yeah. But it's a lot. There's a giant river of resources running through the economy, you know, through the kind of healthcare sector. And if you, you know, kind of thought about that, like how would we leverage that incredible, you know, ocean of cash, what would we want it to do, right? What could we do with it? What should we do with it? And who ought to have a say? You know, what are the spending priorities, but how do we decide what the spending priorities are? And I think in some ways that's what is being debated, right? There is this, you know, incredible, there's a lot of resources, you know, running through that institution one way or another. And should they be used to create, you know, good jobs? Should they be used to create $6 million executive salary? Should we be building facilities in Qatar and Ireland and Italy and Cyprus and having jets to fly executives there, you know, to deliver life-changing medicine? You know, and should we, I don't know if this is quite where you were headed, Rick, but you know, there is a community health aspect to this, too, you know. I actually saw an interesting little pie chart, and it was put out by the Pitt, the School of, I think that's it, Gistia, anyway, the School of Public Health, has been engaged as I think part of the Affordable Care Act to really, you know, do some of this community needs assessment work that the Affordable Care Act says has to be done, you know, to really, like, look at a community, what are its health needs, you know, try to be a little analytical about it, try to think about how to target resources where the problems are. And they just made this really interesting little pie chart that is, like, where does health come from? What really contributes to morbidity and mortality in a community? And I haven't got it in front of me, but I'm not misremembering too much. You know, in that pie chart, like your health, about 10% of your health is actually delivered by an acute care hospital. And like a full 40% of your health is accounted for by your kind of economic circumstances. And then there's another 20% that's about, like, I don't know, you eat lead paint. It's sort of like your environmental stuff. But, like, the health of a community, not much of it actually comes out of a hospital if what you think a hospital is strictly your liver transplant, right? A lot of it comes out of a hospital if you start to think about a hospital as your liver transplant plus the wages, right, plus, you know,
right. So,
the other ways in which we create, you know, health.
Sure.
And so that is what I think people are talking about. That's what I think people are talking about.
And it's why when you talk about that $15 an hour wage, I mean, there is a way in which that's a healthy wage standard.
And it would be, that's what I'm saying.
No, that would be it in, you know, for those particular workers, because their families, would have enough income to pay their bills to meet that self-sufficiency standard. But you're also right, because of the impact of UPMC on other wages, you really are talking about healthy communities because you reduce poverty, because you create a more robust middle class. I mean, another piece of this is, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I think it's over half and going to grow, which is the share of the healthcare dollar that's public money, right? I mean, a lot of it's Medicare and Medicaid and
I think the last time I saw, this kind of accounted for, you know, when you throw it all together, all the little bits and pieces, you know, yeah, it's like 65% of healthcare funding is actually, you know, ours.
Right, right. So which I was, as always, being conservative and careful.
It's right, my job. Right.
But it's absolutely outrageous that, I mean, Romoff's salary to the entry level salary is order of magnitude 300 to 1. I mean, that is, you know, and using, okay, if you're right on the numbers, money that's almost 2/3 public money. And it's so, again, for the healthcare leader to do something that, as you're pointing out, undermines in fundamental ways health for those workers and families, health for the broader community, is just outrageous.
Well, it is. And it's also, you know, to me, an interesting way to pose, you know, it's an interesting question to pose, and I actually think we should have an honest conversation about it, right? If we're talking about dollars that are meant to deliver health, where is that dollar best invested?
Right.
And,
right.
You know, there's an argument to be made, right, that it's best invested in, or at least one of the good places to invest it is the people who are doing the work, you know, in those buildings who live in the community around the hospital. I think the pie chart shows it. I think, you know, common sense shows it. And so, you know, I think one way to describe the debate that's happening in Pittsburgh right now is a debate over the investment strategy. And what people are saying is, we have not had enough say in the investment strategy. If we had had a say in the investment strategy, the priorities of the institution would look different. There would not be $6 million. You know, there would not be debts going to Cotter. There would not be. And so we need to have a voice in the investment strategy. Workers are saying that. City council people are saying that. The public health community is saying that. The public health community is saying, yeah, if we had a say, if we got to vote, not to dictate, but a little bit of a voice, we would not be living in the shadow of a $10 billion global health enterprise and have the highest infant mortality rate, or one of the highest infant mortality rates in the country, in our African-American community.
Well, and I really do hope that you can figure out how to get really a systematic study done, because if you use that health care dollar, you know, slightly differently, so let's say achieve that $15 an hour wage and then pushed up some of the wages close to that and pushed down the wages on top. But first of all, the increase in wages is still, I know it's going to be modest, because in terms of the health care dollar, because, you know, most of the health care dollar is going to the better off workers and professionals, and it's also going these days to technology in healthcare, which is very expensive. But then second, I mean, as you know, but some folks in the audience may not think about, there's a lot of research that when you treat entry-level employees better, you get, for example, lower turnover. And also there's other research that when hospitals have more supportive human resource practices, they actually achieve higher quality care, lower cost of care. And so even before you get to the issue of the impact on families' well-being and community well-being, I mean, you're going to get most or all of your money back from actually investing a little more in that lower wage workforce. So, I mean, to me, again, it's different, but then again, there is an analogy. When you go back to that manufacturing economy that you talked about, the steel economy, the auto economy, at a certain point, Henry Ford figured out that by paying his workers decently, he created the consumer market that created the demand for cars and allowed, you know, his company to grow more and more profitable decade after decade. And even General Motors in the 30s in Chrysler, they all figured out to make their peace with unions, to create that mass market. And also, frankly, in those companies, you were talking about very capital-intensive operations. So labor stability, low turnover, you know, workers who develop skills over the course of a 30-year career and learn how to run their particular machine, et cetera, you know, made a lot of sense. So in the end, it worked at the level of the economic system. It worked absolutely at the level of those companies, which were fantastically profitable for decades. And it worked at the level of society. So, I mean, I think to some extent what you're pushing on, Lisa, is if we can have this broader conversation about since what UPMC does now and, you know, what some other large for-profit and not-for-profit corporations do really kind of isn't working for the community as a whole. But if we sort of tweak it, you know, that we can get to something that works a lot better for everybody.
Well, I you know, it's why we want to have the conversation. You know, people know it from history, you know, kind of people intuit it in the present. People believe because they were, you know, raised in families where we made better decisions when we talked about things together, you know, where when you have all the stakeholders have a real voice and not just a, you know, pretend voice, you know, that we get to better places. Now, that does presume, right, that everybody who's in the conversation thinks that everybody else in the conversation has a right to be in the conversation. You know, I mean, there's a presumed us in my vision of how things ought to be, or in your vision of how things ought to be. And, you know, and I think what's being contested to some degree, and what's, you know, clear is that the management at UPMC does not have that same sense.
And you're actually going the last place. We will let you go in a few minutes, but the last place I want to go, because Irwin and I, it's actually Irwin Aronson, not Rick Smith.
Sorry, Irwin.
Because, no, it's fine, it's fine.
It's all right, I marked it down on your record.
We're subbing for Rick. We give Rick a break once in a while, once in a long while. But
and we may give you a break in a short while.
No. But no, I want to, because we're going to talk after 11 o'clock, we're going to talk about Michigan.
Right.
And the right to work fight
right.
there.
Right.
And, but so in a strain, so I actually, so I want to talk a little bit about worker rights at UPMC. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. again, my understanding is that early this year, a group of workers, you know, reached out and mm-hmm. there is within that workforce some folks who really think that a union, would serve them well. And so talk about how that's going and talk in particular about UPMC's response to that.
Okay. So, you know, it's about the same, you know, with, I guess, sort of inside the building as outside the building. You know, there are people. I have been so surprised by the, I'm going to start outside the building. I'm going to move in because I know you want to, you know, we all want to talk about that. So surprised. At the, you know, kind of level of interest people have in having this conversation, and really how could it be anything other than that? The giant institution, it touches everybody's lives in so many ways. And when you start a conversation as the work that UPMC did, you know, a lot of people jump in. The institution's response, I think, has been sort of uniform, whether you're inside the building or outside the building. You know, and the response has been, there's nothing to talk about here. Everything is already fine. That's, you know, been part of the response. They, you know, put out a leaflet saying, you know, don't talk to us about community benefits. We already give you everything. and did some math. The Tribune Review responded by saying, this is math for dummies. You know, this doesn't work, and we know it doesn't work. You know, inside the building, you know, the employer responded,
partly by saying, you know, everything here is fine. There were communications that said, you know, we're, you know, competitive and we have, you know, open doors and UPMC cares and all of that. And then there was, you know, and then there was the, and then there was the iron fist in the velvet glove. I mean, it's interesting to be talking today. It's really just today that, we saw that the labor board, the NLRB, issued a complaint, about, you know, workers went to the NLRB to talk about what was going on in their buildings. And, you know, the complaint is just, you know, it's a sort of, well, here, let me have a peek at it. it's a litany, involving, you know, UPMC management at the highest level. I mean, named in the front of the complaint is Greg Peasley, who's the director of HR for, I think, the entire system, and Elizabeth Concordia, who is, you know, kind of widely understood to be sort of the heir apparent, maybe, for Jeffrey Romoff, and, you know, just on and on and on and on. And the, you know, the charges range from, you know, unlawful firings to, you know, just the kind of, you know, sort of clamping down on people who want to have this conversation that, you know, range from, you know, just unfair and, you know, coercion and polling people and saying to them, you know, your name will go to the very top, and if the union comes, you should call the police, and if you visit or give, you know, employee information to another employee, that's, you know, punishable, you know, up to and including termination. It just goes on and on and on. I mean, some of it is almost, you know, you just sort of want to laugh.
Well, you want to laugh, except that
you want to cry.
You want to cry, and we know a couple of things. This is 2012, not 1912. And this is a so-called enlightened employer who enjoys a very special status in our economy, that of a non-profit, that gives them special governmental-sponsored protections that they're using, apparently, to exploit the very wonderful people who are employed by them, the same people who, based on a week of work, need to avail themselves of food banks in order to feed their families.
Right. So I mean, the question that Steve asked is, you know, what has their response been? I mean, the response has been, you know, this conversation is not going to happen. That's what the response has been. We're not having this conversation. We will prevent you from having this conversation by methods both legal and illegal.
Imagine, if you will, that one of the employees of UPMC took a morsel of food off of a tray, you know, a roll, a cup of fruit. What would happen to that person? That person would be terminated summarily. But these people can violate our labor laws openly and notoriously, and we need to beg the labor board to issue a complaint, and then they get a due process hearing before anything could happen. And the anything that can happen is that they be compelled to say, I didn't do anything wrong and I won't do it again.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people are, you know, often sort of frustrated by the mechanism for, you know, ensuring that the that rights of workers to have this conversation are enforced. You know, and I will disagree with you that I've certainly been in that camp. I mean, you know, the truth is, you know, I'm interested to see where this goes. It's a you know, this complaint has, you know, dozens of separate violations. It's, you know, very specific. It's very, you know, clear about what happened, and it asks, you know, UPMC to fix the things that can be fixed, to, you know,
deal
with people's files and restore, you know, and get them returned to work, and to change the solicitation policies that are overbroad. You know, stop having them. You're not allowed to tell people who they can visit when they're not at work,
and
people have the right to talk about the union when they are, you know, not on duty in non-patient care areas. They do, and they're, you know, and they have to stop stopping them from doing that. So,
am I correct in assuming as well that this large non-profit entity, that the healthcare consumers of Western Pennsylvania, as well as Qatar and Ireland and so on, are financing, are using some of the money that is paid to deliver health care to pay for lawyers and others to chase away workers' rights in this context?
Well, you know, since I don't have, you know, I'm not a bookkeeper, so here's what I can say. I don't know where it, you know, comes from. You know, for all I know, they have some kind of, you know, grants from someone to do this. But what you can say is that the dollars spent doing that are not dollars spent producing health. And I cannot for the life of me imagine why, you know, any healthcare institution, you know, should be doing that.
Well, that was my point. As healthcare consumers that we all are, there's a portion of every healthcare dollar we're spending at UPMC that is being used not to deliver any dimension of healthcare, not even to deliver a dimension of medical research, but instead being used to trammel the rights of the people who work there to speak out and possibly actually organize and bargain collectively over wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment. And the rest of the labor movement I know in Western Pennsylvania is pretty outraged by that. It's not just SEIU. It's not just our union.
It's not just the union movement, and this is really what I'm trying to say. I mean, this is a big entity that, you know, needs to be in a different conversation and a different relationship with everybody in the city. And, you know, the people inside the building are, you know, also worried about infant mortality rates and, you know, that we don't have a tax base to retain teachers and we cut our buses. You know, in Pennsylvania, the standard for being a nonprofit it's enshrined in the Constitution and it's pretty high. And the theory of you know, being a charitable institution and receiving tax exemptions is a pretty simple one. In fact, it's one that UPMC itself clarified for folks at this hearing, you know, which is that in exchange for valuable service to the community, the community relieves the institution of further burden, right? And that's what the tax exemption is. And that's the, you know, that's the balance. And what people here are saying is that, you know, it's out of whack. It's just out of whack. And,
almost as if UPMC is relieving itself in a little bit different way.
and what's encouraging, I think, you know, I know UPMC management is not exactly loving it, but I kind of am loving it because what I'm seeing is what is to me a very beautiful thing. People who work in the institution, people who don't work in the institution, elect leaders, you know, really trying to have a conversation about our resources, our leading industry, our economy, our health, and how we build a city that works for everybody.
Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm going to jump in here because we need to take a break.
Okay.
So have a wonderful weekend. We're going to keep talking about this. We'll let you go. Keep us posted. This is an incredibly important conversation you're having, and you're going to win.
Okay.
Thanks, Lisa, and regards to my hometown, and give my sisters and brothers at SEIU 32BJ and SEIU Healthcare generally our best regards from here in central Pennsylvania.
I will do. Thanks.
Thanks. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
90% of the people own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Republican U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell is advocating cutting Social Security by reducing the annual cost of living adjustment, making you wait until age 67 to get Medicare, and capping Medicaid spending per person per year. All those proposals would hurt working people. The AFL-CIO says the so-called chained CPI Social Security cost of living adjustment change doesn't make it more accurate. It just lowers it for seniors struggling with ever higher prices, including higher health care costs. 250 economists have said there's no empirical basis for changing the Social Security cost of living formula. Raising the age of Medicare eligibility would actually increase the cost to the program, not lower them, and capping Medicaid just shifts the cost to states. For more information on what the proposed Republican cuts would mean for working families, go to aflcio.org/protectourfuture. Republicans at Michigan's legislature are thumbing their noses at voters who rejected emergency financial manager powers in November. Jesse Russell explains.
Emergency financial managers in Michigan could soon have the authority to unilaterally reject or terminate collectively bargained contracts. In November, Michigan voters tossed those powers out when they repealed by ballot PA4, but a brand new emergency financial manager bill passed this week could give those powers back. Republicans argued that the legislation is different from the rejected legislation and that it gives local authorities more of a say. It allows local officials the right to provide input in the decision over choosing an emergency financial manager. Local officials can also remove a manager if two-thirds vote in favor of removal. In the assembly, one Republican sided with all the Democrats in passing the bill. The legislation that would allow the managers to once again throw out collectively bargained contracts comes on the heels of Michigan Republicans passing a right-to-work state bill, which diminishes the powers of labor organizations to represent workers.
Should the U.S. have universal automatic voter registration? AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka thinks that we should. Trumka says automatic voter registration is already the norm for most of the world's democracies. Trumka says the AFL-CIO and partners like the Brennan Center for Justice, Advancement Project, DEMOS, the NAACP, and the National Council of La Raza, among others, are working together to develop a strategy to achieve universal and automatic voter registration in the U.S. Workers' Independent News is made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and from OPEIU, the Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
Detroit down, while the boss man takes his bonus pay and chips on out of town. DC's bailing out the bankers as a farmer auction ground. Yeah, while they're living it up on Wall Street in that New York City town. Here in
welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Steve Hertzenberg here.
And I'm Irwin Aronson.
And we are giving Rick Smith a break. Texas, first in poverty, about 50th for educational attainment. Oh, well.
And a state that gets $1.25 from the federal government for every dollar it sends to Washington, unlike here in Pennsylvania where we get something like 90 cents, or in New York when they get something like 86 cents. For every dollar they send to Washington.
So I'm going to go back to the conversation about UPMC, and we're going to talk some more about workers' rights or lack of them in the United States, and we're going to wind our way to the Michigan issue, the right-to-work law that passed earlier this week, right-to-work for less law. But I want to start by talking a little bit to folks about how unusual the U.S. is in terms of some of what Lisa Frank described is going on at UPMC, right? So, again, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC, this mammoth healthcare system, has a bunch of workers, a significant number of workers, who come to the conclusion that they want to be represented by a union. Now, in most countries, most advanced countries, European countries, but even Canada, that's the workers' decision. So in most in Canadian provinces, employers don't have a voice in workers'
decisions
about joining a union. So I mean, the analogy I remember a famous Canadian labor scholar made is does Canada have an interest in what happens in a U.S. election? Yes. But do Canadians have a vote in U.S. elections? No, they don't, because it's Americans' choice. Well, so do employers have an interest in what happens? Does it impact them what happens, whether or not workers choose a union? Maybe. But it's again, this is labor law in other places. The whole notion that employers have a right to weigh in on workers' choice and in practice to coerce workers, intimidate workers not to join a union is a peculiarly American feature of labor law.
Well, it's even more than you may be aware or than our listeners may be aware. Intriguingly enough, you analogize to Canada, and the Canadian statutory framework is almost exactly the same as our Wagner Act, or the original National Labor Relations Act, passed here in the United States in 1935. The words are the same. The interpretation and application are dramatically different. Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act is the section that lays out the rights of working men and women in the United States to have collective bargaining over wages, hours, and terms and conditions of employment, and to choose that freely. Intriguingly enough, Section 7, and by the way, the rest of the National Labor Relations Act, contains no paragraph, no section, no syllable, no phrase, no sentence that confers any rights on employers in that mix. All of the asserted rights here in the United States that employers put forth under the same statutory language that exists in the same language, English, in Canada as it does in the United States, all of that is made and wholly imposed by judges. It's judge-made law. And you would think, with the outcry that the right wing has in the United States over activist judicial action, that how offended they are, that they would be the first in line to say that, hey, our National Labor Relations Act doesn't confer any rights on employers. It's the rights employees have to organize or choose not to, as they shall in their free will. But we don't hear the right wing saying that. What we hear instead is this hue and cry from the right to impose specialized laws that impair contracts and the right to contract, as they did in Michigan earlier this week with the so-called right to work law.
Right. But I'm still going to slow you down.
This is a uniquely American concept.
Yeah. So, and again, what's going on at UPMC is not new. Sometimes governments and nonprofits are a little less extreme than private employers in terms of intimidating workers not to join a union. Unfortunately, sometimes they are every bit as aggressive as private sector employers. But if there's plenty of documented cases of food processing workers or nursing home workers and cases that really make your stomach turn when you look at the details of basically people trying to exercise a democratic right and being fired and being coerced. And then again, as Irwin knows much better than I do, you know, the unions pursue these cases through the courts, and then sometimes you get, you know, back pay after many years for back pay minus what you should have worked.
What you earned to keep body and soul together.
Right. So completely toothless sanctions.
But it's not just that. I think we need to address this. You have to be practical. When someone gets fired, justly or unjustly, in the midst of an organizing campaign,
right,
no matter what the outcome is 3, 4, 5 years hence from a labor board proceeding that is a function of the employer's kick-the-can strategy,
right,
the atmosphere for the other workers who are left behind to make a decision is well beyond chilled. It's not chilled, it's
Soviet.
Killed. It's killed, it's not chilled.
Yeah.
And therein lies the point. And the penalty for that, of course, for the employer is that they pay a portion of what the worker should have earned, and they post the notice that says, as I indicated to Lisa, we didn't do anything wrong, we want to
again. Right. So, again, so we're going over this slowly because we're trying to get across to folks that basically workers in the private sector in the United States in most situations don't really have the freedom to form a union. Those rights are undermined by the scope for employer intimidation and the weakness of sanctions against that. And because that's the reality, I mean, that's why union density in the private sector is 7%. You know, if you look at polls on whether or not people would like a union or like worker voice, you know, the right wing talks about public sector workers who are being, you know, forced to pay fair share to, you know, pay for the cost for the union that lifts their wages and represents them.
And we have the corollary of that in the private sector ever since Beck, the case called Beck, where anybody who doesn't want to join a union doesn't have to join a union,
right,
but because federal labor law, the same one I referred to, the National Labor Relations Act, requires a union to represent all of the workers in a unit,
right,
the union can charge the members, the individual in the bargaining unit who choose not to be members, a fee for the core cost of their representation and the administration of the collective bargaining agreement.
Right. And again, as an economist, I know that the fair share dues that people who don't want to belong to a union pay to a union is a lot less than the increase in wages and benefits as well as the other representational advantages of belonging to a union. But leaving those trees aside for a second, again, my point was, again, there are many, many times more workers in the private sector, based on surveys, who say they would like a union.
Mm-hmm.
Many times more people who say they like a union than belong in unions.
That is, of course, the dirty little secret that the Chamber of Commerce or Chamber of Business and Industry and the National Federation of Independent Business and the Manufacturers Association don't want anybody to hear.
Right. No, that's right. So, to some extent, all power to Lisa and her friends at SEIU and the brave workers of UPMC. We have to have this public conversation about workers' rights to form a union, because unless the public is with the union and provides the backing of workers and the union, our rights and our courts are not adequate to protect, you know, people's rights, and then this second thing I wanted to get to in the UPMC case is, again, the really what we need, and again, what other countries in different ways usually have is, we need a workers at UPMC as a whole to have a right to, if a majority of those folks want to join a union, then those 55,000 workers should have a union. Now, the U.S. labor law, and that's frankly, by having procedures and legal support for forming unions, you know, in a whole big regional healthcare system, or all the janitorial workers in a region. That's how, in a service sector economy like we have today, where workers tend to be at small work sites, whether it's a nursing home or a doctor's office, mm-hmm. Or an individual janitorial contractor, right? So, but U.S. labor law, in a, even beyond the weakness of the sanctions and the scope for employer intimidation of workers, is also very hostile to organizing rights that cut across a whole set of work sites. So, and again, when you've got tiny little fragmented work sites, or even a big hospital, but it's one of 100 entities within a large healthcare system, unionization sort of one trench warfare battle at a time is extremely difficult. So again, the bottom line is you add the hostility to forming unions in a broad regional industry and keeping bargaining at the level of that regional industry outside construction. You add in that hostility to, again, all of the employers' scope to intimidate and the weakness of the sanctions. And again, that's why private sector union density is 7%. That's why we've had this massive increase in inequality. That's why 93% of the gains of economic growth in 2010 went to the top 1%. And so it's this kind of conversation in Southwest that hopefully educates people around, hey, look at what UPMC is doing. Look at what employers can do. The real issue in the U.S. is not that unions have too many rights and the, you know, workers have too much right to form a union. The problem is exactly the opposite. How in today's economy are we going to fix that? We have to have that conversation because that's the only way we really get the strengthening we need in labor rights.
Well, there's no question about it. You've hit the nail on the head. Actually, there will be a day when we should do a show devoted to these topics only and nothing else. On paper, American workers have exactly the rights that you've just described they ought to have, with some clarity, but in practice they don't. And one of the things that, again, Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act addresses is the idea that determination should be made about unionization among people who have a community of interest.
Right.
And because the courts have conferred upon on businesses rights that the Congress never intended, much less mentioned in the statute, when a group of workers who have a community of interest because they all work at the same site but have different jobs at the same site step forward and say, we want to have a union, the employer immediately responds always by saying, no, the nursing staff and the custodial staff and the food service staff at a hospital don't have a community of interest. All the clerical people at the hospital employer in multiple sites are the ones with a community of interest, and all of the custodial staff at a multiplicity of sites are the ones that have a community of interest. So the union goes back then and creates a unit composed of all, for example, the custodial staff in all of the 100 locations of which you speak. And again, the employer comes back and says, oh, no, you don't have a community of interest that way. It's at this workplace.
So it's a lot of legal
It's a lot
BS.
Of legal maneuvering, but it burns up time. During that time, people get punished. They get disciplined. They get discharged. Conditions are changed. Elections are delayed forever, and that was the reason why we pursued the Employee Free Choice Act, to have the election take place, and then if somebody had objections, they could state them. And all of this is dealt with in a PR sense under the cover of, we great employers are trying to protect the individual rights of people to have or not have a union. We certainly never could be accused of actually interfering with the free exercise that people have, guaranteed by law, to choose to have or not have a union.
And we'll stay with this for another 2 minutes, and then, Brett, we'll take a break. But we'll stay for this for two more minutes because, again, we're trying to educate people around the realities of what happens when workers in this country have the courage to
And you just hit the nail on the head. For a worker today to step forward and say that she is interested in protecting herself and her coworkers at the workplace takes a dimension of courage that is only paralleled by our wonderful troops that are now in Afghanistan or our wonderful first responders who are running into the buildings as everybody else is running out.
The only thing that's missing really from labor rights in Guatemala or you know some other countries where they've had military dictatorships is the level of physical violence against workers when they try to organize are typically, no, that's not a dimension in most organizing situations.
And with all due respect, while it's graphically very different, it's exactly the same as Guatemala because there is physical violence. When a home has imposed upon it, right before the holidays, a breadwinner who loses her job, where they're compelled to make choices now immediately between medicine and milk and sugar and shoes, having lived from paycheck to paycheck, and the issuer of the paycheck has terminated an important word, and a word used by the military as well. For a different kind of thing. This is the labor management relations equivalent of capital punishment, and it can only be imposed in one direction.
Right. So I'm going to give one more example because of the legal maneuvering, because it brings it to life, some of what Irwin said about employers contesting the community of interest. And, you know, the union comes forward with, we'd like this group of workers to have a union election. No, that's the wrong group. The Harvard Medical School, going back 35 years ago, a bunch of clerical and technical workers at the medical school wanted to form a union. This is talked about in a book called You Can't Eat Prestige. And so they file for an election of that group of workers at the medical school. And Harvard's president at the time is Derek Bach, the liberal co-author of the predominant labor law textbook at law schools at the time. And what does Harvard do? They centralize the personnel office, put a notice, they actually moved, I think, some of the workers' offices.
Well, they definitely did.
So your office is now not here, it's across town. And they used that centralization of certain functions, personnel functions, you know, to actually successfully contest the bargaining unit.
To redefine the bargaining unit.
There's no way. It's a violation of workers' rights. Whether it's firing workers or intimidating workers in more subtle ways, this kind of legal mumbo jumbo, is the reality of workers who want a better life for themselves, want a voice, want a chance to bargain with their employer about their wages, their benefits, their working conditions, their training, their career ladders. This is
the essential point. When a worker is accused of violating a rule, not a law, that worker is out on the street. But when an employer...
Employment at will.
When an employer knowingly, willingly, and intentionally violates the clear terms of a law, not a rule, but of a law, we celebrate that employer and say, what a wonderful business decision she or he made. And that is a social problem. That is a perception problem. When Ronald Reagan broke the law and fired the air traffic controllers, instead of being repudiated, being repudiated by our society, he was canonized by our society. Right. And instead of being repudiated today at UPMC, they are spending the money that was earned in a nonprofit fashion to beat down and browbeat people who are exercising what everybody learned in ninth grade civics class was their right. Was their right as a matter of law in this land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yeah, and for those of you who know the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I've always thought that was a powerful metaphor for, you know, labor management relations gone wrong. And Nurse Ratched is sort of, to me, is a symbol of the autocratic supervisor. And that movie is all about what authority
and power,
abusive authority, can do to human beings, whether it's make the chief suffer in silence or make Billy Bibbit speak with a stutter, and so it's a form of humiliation. It's sort of not having real rights and voice can mean you have lower wages and benefits, and it can have an impact on your economic circumstances. But fundamentally, as Irwin knows again better than me, it is ultimately about voice and dignity. People who don't get a chance to have a fair chance to shape and their lives and have honest bargaining and discussions around what's fair are degraded by that reality. Anyway, the bottom line is the issue in the U.S. is we need stronger rights to unionize. We need stronger worker voice. After the break, we're going to talk some more about Michigan. And you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Stay with us.
For the homeless or the poor, who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Earth, sky.
White dwarfs are the hot, dense remnants of long-dead stars.
They're the stellar cores left behind after a star has exhausted its fuel supply and blown its bulk of gas and dust into space. These exotic objects mark the final stage of evolution for most stars in the universe, including our sun.
White dwarfs are tough to find because they're small. A white dwarf with the mass of our sun would be no bigger than Earth. And as we stand on Earth and look up, we can't see a single white dwarf in the sky with the eye alone. But there are many white dwarfs around us in space.
White dwarfs are born when a star shuts down. A star spends most of its life in a precarious balance between inward pulling gravity and outward pushing gas pressure. The pressure comes from the burning of atomic fuel in the star's interior. As the star ages, it first becomes a red giant, but eventually its outer layers slough off into space, leaving behind the star's core. The exposed core is the newly born white dwarf.
The white dwarf now has before it a long, quiet future. As the trapped heat trickles out, it slowly cools and dims. Eventually, it will become an inert lump of carbon and oxygen floating in space. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Steve Hertzenberg.
And I'm Irwin Aronson.
And we're subbing this Friday night for Rick Smith. You're not too late to join the conversation, so 1-888-520-RICK. Give us a call. We're talking about what we think is one of the most pivotal issues to the future of this country.
And that's 1-888-520-7425.
Which is the right of workers.
Well, I want to follow up on something you said before the break that's really important. On rare occasions, you and I disagree, and this is one of those occasions.
Okay.
The fact of the matter is that workers do not need an expansion of their rights. Workers, as a matter of law, have these rights. What workers need is for a simple enforcement of the statutory and regulatory framework under which they are allowed to, that it's the policy of the government of the United States to encourage organizing and collective bargaining. What we need instead of more rights for workers is the recognition that employers don't have any rights under our statutory framework, and stop this nonsense, this silliness, this absurdity, this Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass conferring of rights on employers in the decision-making process that workers go through, and conferring them in a way where employers have a bigger voice about whether or not workers get to have a union than the workers themselves have. And a much more effective voice. So this isn't a question of needing or even desiring to expand workers' rights. It's a question of simply enforcing the fundamental and clear intent of the law, a law passed initially by Congress in 1935, modestly amended in 47, and modestly amended again in 1959, and untouched fundamentally since then, with the exception of putting health care and hospitals under the ambit of the National Labor Relations Act in the 1970s. Canada, as I said, has the same statutory framework that we do, and they interpret it and imply it so differently. As you know, Steve, our listeners don't, I have a lot of family that lives in Canada, predominantly Toronto. And one of my cousin's kids, is a brilliant young man who is a medical resident in Toronto, as we speak. And his field is radiology. And intriguingly enough, when he became a resident, a medical resident, he also became a union member. And he and I speak rather frequently because he happens to have gotten himself involved on the union committee at the hospital at which he works. And he's asking me questions from the perspective of a physician, a medical doctor, who is very accomplished and will doubtlessly have a very successful practice based on his sensitivity as well as his brilliance. But
he's related to you?
He's related to me, amazingly enough. Well, only by marriage. That's why he has that moniker.
That sensitivity. Yeah.
That sensitivity. And what is extraordinary about it is the insightful questions he asks and how they are responded to by a huge medical system in Toronto that is, of course, a nonprofit and wouldn't dare think about stripping the medical residents, the nursing staff, or the other, what they consider to be non-professional staff at the hospital, of their collective bargaining rights, or interfering or impeding them in any way.
So, yeah, I'm not going to get into a a legal argument with you about, I mean, both you and I want the same practical results.
No question.
So whether or not President Obama saying he wants you to join a union, or Rich Fitzgerald saying in a public way, in that's the county executive, the highest-ranking political official in Allegheny County, where, again, UPMC is anchored, saying in some public way that he supports, you know, workers' rights at UPMC to form a union, and, you know, whether or not we can get through a change in our politics and a change in sort of court interpretations, getting the kind of system we want, or we need legal changes.
Yeah, of course we're not going to argue, because we do indeed want the same result. But let's weave this together just a little bit more.
Okay.
Because I believe that we don't need an expansion of workers' rights, we just need an application of workers' rights that are already guaranteed, the minority of the United States Senate that has, among other things, frustrated President Obama's effort to appoint jurists in a way that has never been seen in the history of the United States. We have more judicial vacancies on the federal court system today than we have ever had in history, all because Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky and his colleagues, who are the minority, not the majority in the U.S. Senate, have threatened to filibuster nominees, who have blocked nominees. We do not have a judicial system that can address these issues, because we don't have enough jurists to do so. And therein lies one of the fundamental problems. Elections have consequences, and we suffer from those consequences. The national movement to delegitimize Barack Obama and his presidency, which we repudiated once again this past November 6th, still lives on, and one of the ways it manifests itself is in this unilaterally imposed disability by a minority group of right-wing extremists who are not representative of the people of the United States, or not even representative of their own Republican Party, has yielded a number of results, and one of them is that we have a deficit on our federal judiciary, the likes of which have never been seen before, and that keeps, among other things, workers from having their rights protected and from having the ability to assert their rights under, among other things, the National Labor Relations Act, but also under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, also under the Civil Rights Act, Title VII, also under the Americans with Disabilities Act, also under the Affordable Care Act. These are extraordinarily serious issues. The promise of this country that we all learned about in our ninth grade civics class needs to be weighed against what the politics are of this country, and the tyranny, if you will, the true tyranny of the minority imposed on the majority by political decision-making that is very oriented toward a result that crushes people in their effort to merely exist. And it's shocking, and it's troubling, and we need to continually speak out about it.
And is one of the, are there vacancies on the NLRB itself now? Or?
Oh, the NLRB really can't function right now because it doesn't have a statutory minimum number for there to be even a majority vote on anything. So the NLRB, for all practical purposes, doesn't exist right now beyond the regional director level.
That's the National Labor Relations Board, which is the first legal body that hears...
The first legal body that actually hears complaints are the regional offices of the National Labor Relations Board and the regional directors, who make determinations about, as Lisa was discussing, whether a complaint lodged by workers goes to a complaint against an employer.
Right.
And the regional directors are the kings and queens, if you will, of their regions. But any appeal from a regional director decision goes to the National Labor Relations Board. And right now, if one has a case that needs to be appealed from the regional director's level on both sides of the equation, employer and worker, where the employers get this right, I don't know, but that's another story for another day. It goes to the NLRB, and the NLRB has been this hotbed of right-wing activity thwarting the president's will to get nominees confirmed again, just like on the judiciary. And so Wilma Liebman is gone. You know, she had been on the board. My old friend Craig, who had been on the board, is no longer on the board, and he is working as a special counsel to the National AFL-CIO. But the real world is that when the right wing was in power in Washington, they installed at the National Labor Relations Board a group of management side labor lawyers who had made their bones and cut their experience and printed
and their millions. Yeah.
Their millions. All off the backs of workers who wanted to assert their rights under our statutory framework. And the Democrats, who were then the majority party, didn't thwart or stop the nomination process, but the minority Republicans during the Obama administration and their lopsided effort to delegitimize Barack Obama and his presidency have, among other things, stopped the process at the NLRB. And it is very, very frustrating and very damning. And from time to time, I think that we look more and more like the former Soviet Union in some things than even I care to contemplate. And it makes me shudder.
Except it's not the Communist Party that's in charge. It's sort of right-wing elements within the...
Well, you know, they had the colossal gall to refer to Obama as a communist or a socialist, yet they are the ones that are engaging in all of the conduct that is that totalitarian approach, that autocratic approach, that the worst of the Soviet dictators ever dreamed of, and the worst of the Maoist dictators ever dreamed of. And then they come back, and Mitch McConnell has been mentioned in this show more than once tonight. Mitch McConnell, who is the floor leader of the Republicans in the U.S. Senate from Kentucky, offered, of course, a real Pennsylvania story when the Harley-Davidson company in York was thinking about the possibility of moving away from York, Pennsylvania, and stealing our jobs. Mitch McConnell stepped up to the plate and decided that it would be appropriate to make a six-figure multi-million-dollar grant to Harley to move to his state of Kentucky. It was over $100 million. This is the same Mitch McConnell who thought that a loan, not a gift, to GM and Chrysler was socialistic and shouldn't be granted. And we know how those things worked out. We know how Michigan today is prospering again through an automobile industry that has paid back its debt to the government of the United States, that the investors, also known as the American taxpayers, actually made money on those transactions that McConnell opposed as loans. But when it came to stealing jobs from Pennsylvania, he was prepared to take your tax dollars and give Harley-Davidson a grant of something in excess of $100 million to steal our jobs and move to Bowling Green, Kentucky.
So, I don't want to depress people too much. So I think part of the message here...
Is that what I'm doing?
Well, is that some sort of short-run political strategies aren't going to fix the problem we're talking about. So it's the kind of conversation that they're having in Pittsburgh. It's sort of... We need to get to a more explicit discussion about what kind of southwestern Pennsylvania do you want, what kind of Pennsylvania do you want, what kind of America do you want. And again, Lisa alluded in passing to the fact that it's not just the UPMC effort that she talked through. That's not an isolated case, that there are a bunch of different places where there are there's activism around how poorly workers in big parts of our economy, often the service sector parts of our economy, and so we've had a flash strike of 200 workers from fast food presidents around New York. We had the worker protests outside Walmart that took place on Black Friday. And those were actually accompanied by, there was a think tank report, which was a time to coincide with the Walmart protests, which sort of asked the question, what if we raised wages to, I think it was $13.50 an hour, or $13 an hour in all of the large retailers in America. That would lift 700,000 people out of poverty, would actually create more jobs because of the money it would put in people's pocket. So I guess where I'm going is that there is more visibility than there's I think there's ever been before to the basic idea that these big parts of our economy with hundreds of thousands or millions of workers, I mean, the retail sector is 13 million workers if you look at the whole retail sector, again, where people don't make enough to live on, but where actually we could reorganize our economy and they would make enough to live on, and it's perfectly practical. So, I mean, I think that's I think making that possibility, the idea of a different kind of economy with a more robust middle class, you know, making that really tangible for people is a very important goal of a lot of these kinds of cases that we just talked about.
Well, not only is it a very important goal for a country, for a state, for a community, to have a race to the top, if you will, instead of this massive race to the bottom. But as people understood somehow in this country in the 1930s and have lost here in the 2000s, it happens to be really good for business.
Right.
We have, beyond peradventure, learned that when we put more money in the hands of rich people, it doesn't help the economy as a whole.
Right.
That was the Bush tax cuts. The so-called job creators haven't created any jobs with those tax cuts. But on the other hand, if we put that money into the hands of working men and women, we know that they're going to buy things. They're going to buy cars. They're going to buy refrigerators. They're going to buy washing machines. They're going to buy clothes for the kids and sneakers when the kids go back to school. They spend the money. And when they spend money, that does what? It creates jobs, real jobs, family-sustaining jobs with family-sustaining benefits and family-sustaining wages. Remember as well that in this little difference that we have, the half generation between your age and my age, I grew up in a world where single wage earner households supported families. Today I'm in a world where two wage earner families can't sustain their household.
A much richer world?
And, you know, we keep
going. Strangely, it's not.
We keep on being told it's a much richer world, and it is a richer world. It's just we're not getting our share.
Right.
And we're not getting not a share that we would like or a share that I would even say we're entitled to. We're not getting the share that we have earned. And that's why when Lisa was speaking of the pay of the CEO of UPMC,
right,
I kiddingly or sarcastically corrected her that it wasn't what he earned, it was what he got paid. I know that the people that are on the other side of that equation don't get paid what they earn.
Right.
And I know that the CEO of UPMC and his multiplicity of colleagues that are in private, non-profit, semi-profit, and for-profit entities are dramatically overpaid relative to what they actually earn. What is the value that they add to the mix? What is the value that a company that acts as a conduit between and among the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and Camelot, this company, Greenhill and Company, what do they actually earn? What do they bring to the mix? Because I know that our folks, our hospital workers, our construction workers, our healthcare workers, our teachers, our firefighters, our police, our manufacturing workers, have something that they bring to the mix that is measurable, that's quantifiable, that does something for us every day. And they don't get paid for it, and we are told we should resent what they earn. We are told that we should be offended by the pensions that they earn. We are told that we should be resentful of the health care to which they are entitled that they earned. And somehow or another, faux news and many other media outlets repeat this enough, it becomes the vernacular, it becomes the accepted view of our time, when indeed it is exploitation and exploitation to a degree that I am confident my parents would be rolling over in their graves about if they heard it happening.
So again, we're trying to tell a different story about a different world that we can create. And again, one of the things you talked about is if you raise the wages of workers in these lower wage parts of the service sector, you do create that market. And, you know, in the Black Friday Walmart protests, you know, one of the quotes was, Henry Ford understood you don't create a great consumer market by nickel and diming workers. Walmart needs to learn the same lesson, bringing visibility to the fact that Walmart's workers aren't sharing in its phenomenal profitability is an important part of the educational process. That was actually me. Quote, you knew that. Quoted in Salon magazine.
Yeah.
But it's, again, it is, people are beginning to connect the dots. And so there's also a story, a New York Times columnist called Eduardo Porter. Mm-hmm. He did a story called Unionizing on the Low End of the Pay Scale. And Erwin, you know this, but our audience doesn't. He goes through a series of these examples in different parts of the service sector, whether it's fast food or whether it's Walmart or whether it's car washes in New York and Los Angeles. And he retraces some of what's happening to the janitorial industry. And he recovers what he says is the 90s and 2000s. I actually think this has its origins in Pittsburgh and some of the early thinking behind this in about 1986.
Yeah.
What had happened is the janitorial industry, if you went back decades, had been like a lot of the private sector, pretty much union. But then what happened is as union density in general went down and the courts, as we've discussed, the activist courts more and more expanded the scope of employers to really frustrate workers' rights to form a union. And we also had, in that period, we had a lot of undocumented immigration from Mexico in particular. And so what you had starting in L.A., but then you know, spreading to other places, building owners who would have a contractor, and if that contractor was union, they'd get rid of it. They'd have a 30-day and out clause. Either mm-hmm. party can end the contract, and then they'd bring in a new non-union contractor, and if that contractor
that often happen to be owned by the same players.
Yeah, and then they'd do the same thing again, or at times what they would do is when it was about to unionize, they'd call the Immigration and Naturalization Service in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
and basically do a raid that the employer...
And once again, and punish the victims.
Right. The employer hires these people illegally.
The employer...
And calls up the INS.
Yeah.
Whoops, excuse me, I'm knocking something over. Hopefully that wasn't too loud. Sorry for...
used to have a studio here, but tonight instead we have Steve Herzenberg.
I got worried that was my computer. It wasn't. It's only something of Rick and Brett's, so that's fine.
It was the broadcast tower. Don't worry about it.
We're okay now. No, so what happened is that there was within SEIU...
You ought to see what happens when we get Herzenberg excited.
Within SEIU, there was an approach that came to be known as justice for janitors, where the union realized that it couldn't use this broken legal system that we've been talking about and this contractor-by-contractor organizing effort, using the standard National Labor Relations Board elections, but they had to create a campaign for social justice across the community and use a lot of times leverage against the major building owners. In a lot of cities, a few building owners have a big chunk of the downtown property or leverage against the biggest contractors basically call the question in terms of the with the community as well as with the employer around, you know, do these workers deserve to make enough to support their families? And that whole approach, Eduardo Porter in the New York Times, sees it as sort of indicative of a general strategy for, again, the title of his article, Unionizing the Bottom of the Pay Scale. And I think he's right. Now, of course, as Irwin knows, a good friend of both of ours, actually did some research on justice for janitors back in about 1991 and wrote an article called Emerging Forms of Unionism in the Low-Wage Service Sector, which said pretty much everything that Porter says in 1993. In the end, it turns out that you might know what the generally right idea is in terms of, in this case, how do you fix inequality, and how do you create the next middle class? You do it in the parts of the service sector that can't go anywhere. But in the end, you have to figure out how to get the world to understand these things. And Lisa talked about this, really, in terms of, she talked about how UPMC and its scale are kind of new to southwestern Pennsylvania. And so getting their head around how do we deal with this behemoth and what are its responsibilities to the community, whether it's in terms of taxes or in terms of wages, that takes time. And so the good news here, I think, is that in that case, but also in the broader case of the discussion of workers' rights and what it's going to take to lift up wages in our labor market, it feels like the conversation now has moved years forward in the last 2 months.
The conversation is moving forward. The perceptions are also moving forward. But we continue to need to have an air war to cover the ground war.
Right.
Okay. The air war has to do with justice. It has to do with fundamental concepts. I keep referring back to something, not only here tonight on this show, but in virtually every day of my law practice, of the relationship between the promise of America that we all learn about in high school and in elementary school and the reality of our America. And there is a notion of social rent that responsible employers in a responsible American society have an obligation to pay their community rent, their social rent. UPMC can only deliver health care services to people who are earning enough to pay for those services, either directly out of their pockets or indirectly by taking less in the way of wages so that they have an insurance program that delivers health care to them. That's a uniquely American concept as well. And we need to deal with this basic idea of paying community rent if you're going to live off of the community. And with that, I think that we are coming to a close.
The bottom line is we can fix America. We can fix the income distribution. We can create broadly shared prosperity together. Again, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Everyone have a great weekend. Rick will be back on Monday.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.